Chicago Bears and Bulls play-by-play announcer Wayne Larrabee, Neo-Futurist founder Greg Allen, and another installment of The Worst. And now here's your host, a man who unlocked Charizard EX today on Pokemon Go, Justin Kaufman.
Wasn't an EX, it was just Charizard. All right. Welcome to The Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have an unbelievable show lined up for you. Wayne Larrabee's going to be with us. Could you tell my excitement? I kind of went off mic by saying that. The former Chicago Bears and Chicago Bulls play-by-play announcer, now with the Green Bay Packers, is going to join us tonight to talk about his career. Not only calling games for the Packers, which he's done for pretty much, hate to say it, everybody. Almost 20 years, 98, 99. 16, 17 years in Green Bay. Before that, though, but he's called games since 1978. Football games, that's crazy. Wayne Larrabee will join us tonight. I'm excited about that because he arguably called one of the greatest sports moments in Chicago history.
Aaron Rodgers. Beating Chris Conte in that Bears playoff or the last game of the season.
That's second.
Oh.
We should do a top 10 calls of Wayne Larrabee. The first nine would be Packers beating the Bears, right? the best call by far, and everybody knows this, the 85 championship game against the Rams where Wilbur Marshall picks up the sack, picks up the fumble, takes it back to the house, it's starting to snow. The call on that is amazing, and they use that call in all the documentaries and all the kind of promotional NFL films. It's Wayne Larrabee making that call, and Buck is going, go, in the background. So good. And, you know, what a career for him to not only – and this is all at WGN as well, but at WGN-TV to say, oh, I'll do some moonlighting too with this Bulls team, with this guy Michael Jordan. So while he was in Chicago, his first season in Chicago was for the Chicago Bears in 1985. And his last season in Chicago was the 98 Bulls. How about that, huh? I kind of knows. You know, at a certain point, you're like, I think it's time to go. I've pretty much done all the sports broadcasting I can do.
Man.
Cubs aren't going to do it.
And then he goes to the Packers.
And then he goes to the Packers, and it's win, win, win.
Yeah.
It's like a DJ Khaled song. It's just...
I don't even know what that means. DJ Khaled.
Yeah, come on. Oh man, I'm too street for you, Pete.
You are.
All I do is win, win, win. Anyway,
get him back.
Yeah. So we'll talk with Wayne Larrabee coming up at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock coming up at 8 o'clock. A little bit later in this show, we will talk about some media stories that are happening. Tronc's vision for the future of online media. There's talk about a strategy for the former Tribune publishing company to really do a deep dive into online video, to produce videos, volumes, hundreds of videos a day, and using automated content to be able to do that. Now, is there a track record for this? Because there is. There were some companies in the early part of this decade that tried to do that with text. And while it started fast, it died faster. And so we'll talk with Scott Smith. He'll be here to talk about whether or not lessons have been learned and what to take away from Tronc's sort of doubling down on online video content. That's all the rage. The other rage, of course, Pokemon Go. You heard Ro talking about it all show in the last – pretty much everybody's talking about it. It's crazy. And, I mean, it's everything that Nintendo wanted. You know, just got a text saying that their 12-year-old – 214 says, I have a 12-year-old, and she's out right now traipsing around Bucktown catching Pokemon.
Seems dangerous.
Yeah, what's Bucktown? I mean, I doubt it's – maybe she's unaccompanied, but something tells me she's not, right? maybe. That's – go find your – that'll be an interesting. Go outside and find your Pokemon. Give me some space. Mama's got a drink. Right? Yeah, so we'll talk about that. And whether or not the what's behind that sort of augmented reality, whether or not that's the future of not only video games and entertainment as we know it, but if media can find ways to be able to capture that same technology and whether or not that's what we're going to see with media companies moving forward. You kind of see it a little bit in what Snapchat's doing. It's very similar to what Pokemon Go is. Obviously, Pokemon Go to a whole new height. But we will see what happens with media, and we'll talk with Scott about that. Coming up at 9 o'clock tonight, the Neo-Futurists. Too much light makes a baby go blind. Makes the baby go blind. One of the it is the longest running late night show in Chicago history. Started in 1988, and the creator and founder of that company, Greg Allen, is still in Chicago. He is going for a new look, which is a world domination look. So they now have the show Too Much Light in New York, San Francisco, Montreal. They toured around the country. It's also there's rumblings that it might be outside of North America.
Wow.
Talking about Nashville, other places as well. But Greg Allen's going to be here. Great guy, and a great, thoughtful voice for Chicago theater. I mean, they've done so much. Have you been to the Too Much Light?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah. It's almost like a rite of passage for Chicago.
You
got
to
come in from wherever you're at, whatever suburb, to come in and be a part of this show and go roll the dice and sit on the floor and watch. It's formed many young minds here in Chicago, and it's coming up in it's 28 years old.
I still, I live near there, and I'll go, it's like the dead of winter, like the coldest day of the year, and the line is still around the corner waiting to get into late show.
It's unreal. I mean, we talked yesterday just about with Tim Rader about how do you get butts in seats? How do you effectively put the right show in front of the right audience? And obviously in 1988, think about that. Whole different game. There was not a 10 o'clock. Any shows were happening after 10 o'clock. It's a very punk rock DIY aesthetic that was happening with the Neo-Futurists, and they were able to turn it into which is essentially a Chicago tourist attraction. You know, to be an off-loop theater in Andersonville at Ashland and Foster. To be above the funeral home. I don't think that's funeral home anymore, but it used to be. But Greg's a real, like I said, I mean, he's an insightful guy when it comes to theater. I've had great conversations with him over the years, and I'd love to, it's great to have him back on. He'll be on at 9 o'clock tonight. Also tonight, it's time for the worst. Are you ready? I'm ready. TJ Jagodowski and Abby McEnany, two great Chicago improvisers, are going to be in studio with us to help play the worst. The worst. What's the worst? Drawing a blank. The best way to say it. For me, the worst is, and I say this lightly, but is protest memes. I'm done with protest memes. It feels like every third post on social media right now is a protest meme. I'm all down with protests and on both sides and issues and understanding, but we don't need the protest meme.
No.
Nah, I'm done with
them. Done with them.
Yeah. How about you? Got one?
Sports polls.
Like, who's going to win this game kind of stuff?
Yeah. I was watching the Wimbledon final with Milos Raonic and Andy Murray. And, Murray's up 2-0, and it's like, right on the bottom, do you think Milos Raonic is going to come back to win this game? 85% no, 13 yes. who's doing that?
Who is sitting at home being like, I got to get on a poll. I think he's going
to
come back.
My voice needs to be heard.
My voice needs to be heard right now. That's good. 773 says, based on the guy in the studio's laugh, Pokemon players now know where to find Pikachu. I guess it's you.
Is Pikachu?
Pikachu.
Pikachu's...
Maybe he goes,
does he really?
I don't know, but I'm assuming that's what a Pikachu would do, right?
I am ignorant into all of this type of video game app.
Well,
craze.
beyond the app stuff, and that's what I mean. I'm fascinated because Pokemon is not, Pokemon Go is just a heightened version, a 2.0 version of Pokemon, which is still being sold in bulk at the Targets and the different stores where you can actually go in and buy the cards. They have the cards next to the baseball cards. They eclipse baseball, football, all the other sort of, tchotchke cards. Mm-hmm. It's all Pokemon. They'll have a whole wall that'll just be for essentially the role-playing card game stuff. And that's what everyone will bring the binders to school and they'll look at, say, I've got the whale, I've got the Pikachu, I've got Pikachu EX, I've got Charizard. We talked at the top. That's like one of the big ones. So this is really just a, you know, it's an outgrowth of using the technology to take it to the next level, because one of the fun things about Pokemon is collecting the cards and going and getting a collection, just like in the old baseball when you're or football trying to get Walter Payton, mm-hmm. or trying to get Ryan Sandberg or whatever it is. You're like, oh no, I just got the second baseman for the Padres again.
Yeah, those are the worst. Another Warren Brewster.
Oh, man, another Alan Wiggins. I got seven Alan Wiggins. So yeah, so that's that. I mean, that's a concept, and so I get it. I get it. I think that's
absolutely
interesting. I do agree that it's probably annoying. And you know what's even more annoying is I just went to get food before I came right before the show started, and now I'm thinking every person that I see on the street with looking in their phone is playing Pokemon Go. And they're not. They're looking at Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and everything else in between, and the news and text and everything else. And I'm just like, well, they're playing Pokemon? I need to write this down.
Well, it seems to be overtaking the world.
Leave it to Nintendo and Pokemon to take to distract everybody from the ills of society today. It's like, you know, it's like, I don't know what that says about where we live, Pete. I really don't. All right, news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This here is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. All right, let's get this show on the road, shall we? Tonight, the carryout. This is where I read the newspaper, so you at home, you don't have to. Here today's top stories. Presidential candidate Donald Trump was in Chicago for a fundraiser where he hopes to raise a cool million. That's it? $1 million? Seems like nothing nowadays. Now on to Indianapolis, where there's talk that he may introduce his VP candidate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence. All I know about Pence is that he wanted so bad to be Mitch Daniels. That's about it. And it seems like every time the country went in one social direction, the state of Indiana went in another, which really means, hey, that's a great GOP candidate for vice president. And the other potential VP candidate, Newt Gingrich, was let go by Fox News today. The news channel cited a conflict of interest. Can't even say that with a straight face. Another Illinois GOPer is not going to the RNC this year. GOPer. Former Senator Kirk Dillard is skipping with a wink and a nod. No comment. And Governor Rauner deflected questions about Trump today when asked why the sitting Illinois Republican governor wasn't at the fundraiser. His answer?
I'm thinking about not going because I'm governing.
Don't blame me for that. That you created this, governor. Stop dropping the G's. Secretary Hillary Clinton got the endorsement of Senator Bernie Sanders today, who said she had to be the next president of the United States. But will Hillary be able to sway young voters? I mean, think of it like this. Think of the candidates like Vegas hotels. Trump, well, he's like Caesar's Palace. Gold, black, fluffy robes. You know, where your rich grandpa gambles. Hillary, she's more like Mandalay Bay, gold, red, where your rich grandma gambles. And you just want to stay where Tiesto DJs, right? So yeah, young people, they're just going to stay in their rooms this election, or maybe not even come back to the room at all. Does that make sense? Bernie, did that metaphor make sense? Hello? Who's this? Hello? I can hear you breathing. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich wants out of prison. He's been busy tutoring, teaching history, and playing in the band the Jailhouse Rockers. Come on, let him out. Just so we can see Blago on every morning news show every time his band plays at Cubby Bear. Hey, the Jailhouse Rockers coming up in Martyrs on Thursday night. Former governor is here. Hey, guys, thanks for being here. Hey, you want to do the countdown? Whatever it is that they do on morning news. Pokemon Go, the app making news writers around the country be orgasmic, is in trouble again, this time because users could get characters at the U.S. Holocaust Museum. That's a good way to get everybody to hate your game, to have 17-year-olds ignore the Holocaust ever existed just to play it. Gross. Two bank robberies today, including a Fifth Third Bank on the north side. You know what? That would never have happened at a chorus. Bob Mariano, the namesake of the Mariano grocery store, announced today that he is retiring. No word on whether or not he'll spend his days walking the grocery store, pocketing loose grapes, and arguing with the kid who crushed the chips when stocking the shelves. I have a coupon! We know, Mr. Mariano, you have a coupon. In weather, is it stormy yet? Because it feels like there's a storm coming. In sports, it's All-Star Night in San Diego, where Chris Sale's on the mound for the AL. If you can't find it on TV, it's the game where it looks like your TV broke and it only shows brown and yellow, or maybe your cat puked on the screen. Jake Arrieta is not supposed to pitch, instead taking a break to get ready for the second half. I blame you, old New York Met coach. Way to take our joy away in Chicago. You will pay, Met. You will pay. 9 Chicago players are in San Diego. Quintana is supposed to pitch in the 5th inning tonight. This is just a reminder that when baseball starts back up, we will have the Crosstown Classic in July. This year, it's just 3 games all weekdays. That's no fun. That's not enough time for either team to intentionally throw at each other. What else is going on in Chicago sports today? The Bears and Alshon Jeffrey have till Friday to get a contract done, or Jeffrey will play the full year on the franchise tag. This, along with the ESPN preview that says the Bears have no chance to compete in the NFC North, has me saying 13-3. Maybe 14-2, but 13-3 for sure. Before they even play a preseason game, that's my prediction. Camp starts 2 weeks from tomorrow. And finally tonight, Amazon Prime is wrapping up its huge sale day. So if you like 30% off useless tchotchkes and out-of-date video games, Amazon Prime is for you. Amazon Prime, finding new ways to sell you useless sh**. That's the carryout for July 12, 2016. For a limited time with the order, we're giving away Pokemon cards. You know, the real deal OG Pokemon cards. Not this poser app nonsense. How about that? Chris Bryant, home run in the first inning off of Chris Sale in tonight's All-Star game. Coming up, we'll talk media, Pokemon Go, Trunk, and which side the protests and police. Everybody thinks the media's wrong. 720 WGN, stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with legendary play-by-play man Wayne Larrivee. Calls games for the Packers now, but before that, he was the voice of the Bears and the Bulls and called some of the biggest moments in Chicago sports history. So we'll talk with Wayne Larrivee coming up at 8 o'clock. And at 9 o'clock tonight, Greg Allen from Neo Futurist, Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, will be in studio. 10 o'clock, the worst. Well, media news, you know, Vox put out a Vox.com put out a great story today talking about Trunk, Tribune's, the new name of the Tribune publishing company, really sort of drilled down and took a look at their idea, one of their strategies to produce 2,000 videos a day. 2,000 videos a day. There's a strategy behind it. I don't know if it's going to work, but that's why we have our guest tonight, Mr. Scott Smith. He is the director of editorial content at Teamworks Media, and he's also our download media correspondent. Scott, good to talk to you. How are you, man?
I'm good, Justin. How are you? I'm busy trying to edit, see as many videos as me, one human being, can produce.
That's a lot of videos. I mean, it's amazing because that was put out as their sort of, you know, as part of their strategy platform not too long ago when they said this is what we want to do with the company with Trunk. But this piece really is sort of a takedown of automated content and how it's now moving into video.
Right. And it's a follow on this New York Times piece by John Herman from yesterday that really kind of took a look at companies like Demand Media and sort of what is it, you know, what does it mean to produce that? I think when people heard Michael Farrow, you know, the head of Trunk, saying that he was going to produce 2,000 videos, I think people, that was, you know, kind of crazy. You know, we were at, they used to be at Touch Vision, a news and video startup, and we did maybe 15 to 20, and those are all sort of human created and things like that. And so the idea that you would do that many is nuts. And, you know, it had to be that human beings couldn't create this content. This was really some kind of automated content making process. And the New York Times looked at companies like Wibbitz, and that's W-I-B-B-I-T-Z, mm-hmm. That essentially take a script and have a sort of computer read it, generate images to go along with it, edit them together, you know, maybe just sort of, you know, smashing them together, if you will, and creating a voiceover for it. And that's essentially what they create that's a video. And when you watch these videos, and if you go to something like Wibbitz, you can see what they create. A lot of it seems very strange. It feels like a sort of robot put it together. It's what like a robot would imagine good video content would be. It's very spare in detail. It's, you know, essentially robots creating content for other robots.
Well, I mean,
it's not something a human being would want to watch.
It's important to make that distinction, too, because, I mean, there's video production and there's the art of video production, which is done by professionals and you know, artists and filmmakers around the world. But then there's also video automation, which is essentially the idea of video being a platform. And that's where Mike Farrow and Tronk, they believe the future of media is going, where we're going to be much more visual. We're going to be not unlike what we're seeing with Pokemon Go, but the idea that everything's going to be on our phone and we're going to be consuming different forms of media like video at alarming paces. And this is sort of an idea of where we see Tronk going.
Right, and the basic underpinnings of that strategy aren't necessarily incorrect, the idea that mobile will be more important and people will consume different kinds of content. But you have to have an idea of what a human being is really interested in order to get them to watch video. Video is sort of, for a number of reasons, is notoriously difficult to get people to engage with. It's usually longer. People aren't always in the place where they can watch a video when they're looking at things on the internet. You know, they, in most cases, people will tell you that they would rather kind of read an article than watch a video. So there has to be a fairly significant drive in order for somebody to watch a video, which means it has to tell a story, you know, on three or four times as well as an average piece of text. And so, you know, what we've seen with a lot of automation companies is that they've taken things like, let's say, Little League sports scores and been able to put out a pretty good, you know, approximation of a story. And that technology has actually become better and better. But the technology for where video is in creating something like that on an automated basis is nowhere near as good. And to essentially say that you are going to put a big part of your company's content strategy on top of technology that is not ready for prime time, it's seen by many people as a huge misstep.
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm intrigued as someone who I guess inherently believes that these people at the top of this company, you know, are well aware of the automation missteps of the past, that they're not just sort of spitballing and being able to put this together, that they've seen this and are able to evolve it. And one of the things that is involved in this story that's coming out right now is that the idea that if you're going to produce 2,000 videos a day, that's ad revenue, meaning revenue is going to be on it's going to be on the top of each video. This is the idea of the future. That's where advertising wants to put their money. So they want to produce where advertisers are paying. It is interesting that seems like that would be good. And the second part is you can kind of trick Google in a way or social media to put video up and put it up there because and get good Google search ranks in the way to be able to popularize your content.
Right, but you know, you can only trick Google for so long.
Right.
You know, eventually, and much like Facebook, you know, Google wants people to continue to be happy with what they as a platform provide. So, you know, Facebook is always going to make sure that whatever content people seem to like the most, and in this case right now, Facebook thinks it's content from friends and family, is showing up most often in news feeds. Google is going to make sure that the content that is most like what you are looking for is going to show up in the news feed. And very famously, a few years ago, it cut the legs out from under companies like Demand Media that were creating really low-quality content but were gaming the Google algorithms. And their content dropped precipitously,
right,
and the value of the companies dropped precipitously. And, you know, this idea that you can just create more content and the CPMs on it will be the same has not borne out. If you look at we've done more content, we've done more text articles now than I think we ever have before. And we've only seen banner advertising money and the CPMs for banner advertising drop. And that market in the last year has just like cratered. And so we're going to see the same thing happen with video. If we just create a bunch of lousy video and just imagine that people are so hungry for video.
Well, let's
and
say
that's
this,
a,
Scott.
That's
though,
a big assumption. I don't know.
Yeah, but here's where I would push back, just as you and I both know, as sort of being in media for a while. What if it's not lousy? What if the Chicago, as we know it to be Tronc, if Tronc has developed a new style of video, maybe it's a sort of GoPro style, maybe it's putting video to the words of the reports that came out. What if, I mean, let's just say in a perfect world, let's say it's not lousy. Is there a possibility that this is really just a tip to what the future of our media is going to be?
If it is not lousy, they have perfected a technology that other right. people who are at least as well-funded as they are have not yet perfected. And things have jumped really, really right. far ahead. And based on the technology at work and other, you know, feral projects like what he did with the Sun-Times Network, I haven't seen necessarily any evidence of that. But is it possible that, you know, video will be more a part of a user's content diet? That I think is true.
Yeah.
But unless you're actually investing the time and effort into it to actually make it really, really of super high quality. I mean, you look at the thing that in terms of streaming video or in terms of video, the thing that people have been talking about the most is something like the 30 for 30 O.J. Simpson documentary mm-hmm. Made in America. And that was a 7.5-hour researched for years, you know, took a long time to develop. And that was something that's gotten kind of huge, you know, engagement numbers and all that kind of thing. And while you're not going to do 7.5 hours of documentary as web video, it certainly demonstrates that people will gravitate towards really high quality work, but it does have to be high quality in order to get them over the hump of, well, I'm going to watch this video rather than just right. you know, scan through
it's
Facebook page.
It almost feels like it's a 2.0 argument that journalism and media has been having for decades about fast versus, you know, quality versus quantity. The idea that, you know, we've seen journalists who push back on the idea that if you're going to put this much content, whether it be on a website, whether it be in the newspaper, whether it be videos, whatever it might be, you're going to need more resources to be able to do it because you can't count on accuracy or any sort of depth to these articles if it's got to be so boom, 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 boom.
Right, yeah. I mean, we've just seen the kind of, like, you know, race to the bottom in terms of what we're actually creating and, you know, the idea that things kind of, you know, half-truths, you know, on the internet take off at a rate much greater than the eventual corrections do and all that kind of thing. It's sort of we're kind of getting to a bottoming out period where the needle will start to move back in the other direction. But, you know, with this kind of a strategy for video, and to be fair, Tronc is not alone. You know, Bonnier is another company that New York Times mentioned has this partnership with Wibbitz. You know, the idea that companies are taking shortcuts to content has not borne out as a viable strategy on text. And I don't imagine it's going to do that on video.
Well, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with Scott Smith here on the download, and we'll talk about Pokemon Go. I mean, there's a lot of jokes, and we're having a lot of fun with it, myself included. But there is some relevancy to the idea of this app and the way that it has captured people's attention, and it could be the way that we move with media in the future. So we'll talk about that with Scott Smith, who is the Director of Editorial Content at Teamworks Media and our download media correspondent. Stay with us. It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. With me right now on the line, Director of Editorial Content at Teamworks Media, it's Scott Smith. He's our Download media correspondent. Pokemon Go, that's all the rage right now. Everybody's talking about it as a game, but it does have implications for the media world. We're seeing a lot when it comes to augmented reality, in this case for video games, but it could be what we see in the future of how we consume media, right?
Yeah, this is really fascinating. This might be we've been hearing that augmented reality is going to be a thing for, I don't know, maybe 8 years now. And this is the first time that there's been this kind of cultural embrace of it, you know, even though it's, very specific segments of the population. It's now a more installed app than Tinder, a more installed app than Twitter. And it's fascinating. You know, you look through your phone, you see the world around you, but you're essentially a game has been layered on top of the world around you, and you're sort of going around trying to capture all these Pokemon characters so that you can collect enough, and then you go to another place and your character fights against other characters. But the difference here is that you are out in the world and you're walking around and you're engaging in a game, but in a very social way, in the way that I think you and I used to go over to our friend's house and sit around and play Nintendo and that kind of thing. And so there's this really huge social in real life aspect to it that people, you know, who get all incensed about people staring at their phones all sort of ask for. And now we're sort of seeing those two things come together.
Yeah, and I wonder what how we could see that apply to other, you know, situations. Like when you think about what we were just talking about with Tronc, if augmented reality has a place in journalism, if it has a place in what we're seeing with Snapchat and other places where we're kind of seeing the 2.0s and the 3.0s and even the 4.0s sort of manifest themselves on our phones.
Yeah, I mean, there's, I think the argument for augmented reality has always been, you know, you might tour a city and hold your phone up and see, let's say, the way the city used to look 50 years ago or 100 years ago or something like that. But just the getting over the, you know, sort of explaining it to people and getting people used to the idea of the expectation of the technology was always hard. And so perhaps that won't necessarily be so difficult anymore. But what we're also seeing is this idea that, you know, there's, you know, I always say the easiest way to ruin something fun is to send a bunch of marketers over to it and get them to get involved with it. But, you know, there's some interesting things. There's a great Inc.com article that talked about ways in which small businesses might actually get involved in this. And we're seeing some, you know, potentially problematic things like, you know, people trying to chase Pokemon at the Holocaust Museum, which is terrible. But businesses are finding that they are now these Pokestops, and or that they might be one of these gyms where the characters, you know, will fight against each other. And the idea being that, like, there's a bunch of potential customers coming to a business that might otherwise be there. And so what do you do to actually kind of take advantage of that? Right. How do you kind of get in on the gaming fun and stuff like that? And there's all this different terminology, like, you know, throwing down a lure to get these different Pokemon characters to go there, which will then lure actual people. And you can do that by essentially spending Pokecoins to get people to, you know, to use these lures to get these people over there. And the pricing at this point for something like that is really low compared to, say, other forms of advertising that you might otherwise drive people to your business.
Well, I mean, so it's not unlike other gaming systems and what we've seen, you know, with even with PlayStation or Xbox, where the internet has played a big role in sort of introducing concepts to the wider audience. By having augmented reality has such a success with Pokemon Go, it may be an easier sell for a Tronc to start using it, for other people to start using it, because it becomes more indigenous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's definitely, once you've got people used to the idea of the technology, then it becomes a way of, like, okay, what are the different ways we could use that? I mean, there's definitely some, you know, initially it looked as if the app was asking a lot of different permissions of users' Google accounts, and so there have been some data issues. And then obviously the app sucks up a lot of data, a lot of location-based data about where you are, where you've been, the kinds of places you go. And so there are absolutely privacy concerns there. You know, Senator Al Franken has already written a letter to the company asking for more information about that. And so I think, you know, even the people who made the Pokemon Go app got sort of caught by surprise by how much the adoption rate of this game was. And so obviously there's going to be this initial huge spike of interest, and then things will kind of balance out in a certain way. And the same way that we saw things like, you know, Foursquare ending up sort of finding a particular level. And you know, even that, I think they found what they had created with their API and that sort of technical platform that they had created had a lot more use and a lot more revenue generating methods as a company than the idea of people checking in places and being mayors. So the underlying tech behind Pokemon Go seems like a potential platform thing that might take off, more so than the idea of running around capturing cartoon characters.
Scott Smith is director of editorial content at Teamworks Media. He's also the Downloads media correspondent. Scott, thanks for taking some time out. We'll talk to you soon, bud.
Take care. I care for hip-hop, and hip-hop cares for me. And that's the dagger, that's Wayne Larrivee. Come on.
Here I stay with 2:24 to go in the third, and that is the dagger.
It's the download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Well, Bears camp's just 2 weeks away, which also means that Packer camp can't be that far behind. One man who knows the joys of both camps is none other than broadcaster Wayne Larrivee. Larrivee calls the Packers games on the radio, and before that, he called Bears games here at WGN. Larrivee was involved in arguably the best call in Chicago sports history.
Third down, 11 yards to go for Dieter Brock and company. Brock back to pass, the rush on for
Chills listening to that. But it wasn't just the 85 Bears, of course. Wayne Larrivee also did Channel 9 broadcast for the 90s Bulls. He left Chicago to go to Wisconsin, called the Packer games in 1999. Couldn't pass up that gig. We have a great sportscasters in Chicago, no doubt. But it's hard to beat the memories associated with my guest tonight, Wayne Larrivee. Mr. Larrivee, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Justin. How are you?
I'm good. So hearing that clip, I mean, do you... You know, when I think of the calls in Chicago sports history, the 85 championship game against the Rams, that play in the snow comes to mind. That arguably is the best call in Chicago sports history.
Well, you know, that or the end of the Super Bowl, I mean, that was pretty special, too, because if you go back to the 85 season, there was a lot of trepidation throughout that season. I mean, the Bears were great. They were playing great, but everybody was waiting for the other shoe to drop, yeah. And it never did. Because they were so good, and then when they beat the Patriots in that Super Bowl, the dream became reality, and that was a high point.
That was your first year with the Chicago Bears. For you to jump into Chicago Bears football at that point when that team was such a national sensation, talk about the memories that are associated with that team, obviously winning a Super Bowl and being such a big part of Chicago, but just the circus element that went around it.
Well, Justin, I mean, you know, I had been in Kansas City for 7 years and had done the Chiefs and the great coach Marv Levy, and they were rebuilding, and the best year they had was 9-7, and they lost six of their last eight games to get to 9-7 that year, and a couple of years later, I ended up in Chicago, the 85 Bears, and you know, I really wish I had either gotten there earlier or had a few more years prior to the championship season, because it just hit us all so fast. I mean, it was almost like, you know, it was one of those things where when it was over, you said, what just happened here? You know what I mean? The games had just been at WBBM for like 8 years, and they came back to WGN where, you know, they belonged and where they had been for so many years prior. And they put together myself from Kansas City, Jim Hart, who just retired from the NFL as a quarterback and had been a Lake Charles native, and then Dick Butkus over the top of that to kind of give it a Chicago flair. And they put us together, and that was our first year in the booth, and what a year it was. Yeah. I mean, no one could imagine something like that happening.
You know, there's so much. I mean, obviously the history of that team is well documented and has been the last year with the 30 for 30 and everyone looking back. But it's the little things. I was reading an article about, you know, this was before the Soldier Field renovation. Talk about calling a game at the old Soldier Field. Like, it wasn't the best place to be able to do play-by-play.
No, it wasn't. Soldier Field was, you know, built for the Olympics and built for track and field. It was never built for football. And, I think it had a hard time with football. Now, the configuration now of Soldier Field and the way it is, and I understand a lot of people from the outside say there's this spaceship they dropped in among columns. It may not be the prettiest thing in the world, but the sight lines are so much better for the fans. From the media standpoint, it's not as good because we're low, we're under the upper deck, that type of thing. It's not a very good stadium still to broadcast a game from. But you go back to the 80s, and here you are in the stadium. You're kind of far away from the action, and, you know, that made it a difficult broadcast, definitely. But nonetheless, it was great to be a part of all that.
You know, Wayne, take us back to your first days. I mean, 1978 with the Chiefs, but even before that, what got you into broadcast? I mean, to be a play-by-play announcer, obviously there's experience and understanding the game, but what do you have to do to get into this field?
Well, you know, really, and it's different today, and there's no one single path in this business. Everybody has a different path. It's kind of like a golf swing. Every golf swing is different. I think every path in this business is different in one way or another. But back then, I felt coming out of college that if I could get some commercial experience while I was in college, and I did, back in Massachusetts, I went to Emerson College in Boston, which today has one of the best, you know, sports broadcasting schools in the business. But, you know, back when I was in there, I worked on weekends, you know, back in Western Massachusetts where I was from. I worked, you know, on the radio. I had commercial experience. I broadcast games. And then I got a job. I took a semester out of school and went down to Pampa, Texas. Pampa is a little, I want to say, north and west of Amarillo, Texas, up in the panhandle. But I did, you know, Friday Night Lights.
Wow.
And that was a great experience.
Yeah, what a
great
experience.
And then I came back to college, finished up, and then got a job in Davenport, Iowa, doing Iowa Hawkeyes football. Back in the days when Big Ten teams didn't have networks, they had, you know, a number of broadcasts across the state. In other words, Iowa had 13 broadcasts. So Cedar Rapids had a broadcast team. Davenport had a broadcast team, which I was doing. You know, Des Moines had a broadcast team. Waterloo had a broadcast. I mean, there were 13 of us, different broadcast teams, and it was a great experience. And after that, I got the job in Kansas City doing the Chiefs at 23 years old, and that was a wonderful experience.
Now, it's well documented as well that you are a lifelong Packer fan. So we'll let that slide a little bit when it comes to one of our great Chicago broadcasters being a Packer fan. But the opportunity to go be the voice of the Packers, I mean, you can't pass that up. I mean, for that experience, to make that decision to do that, to go to Green Bay, that's a no-brainer for you.
Well, you know, I grew up as a kid in Western Massachusetts, and I – you know, I must admit, I'm a contrarian by nature. My two teams were the New York Yankees, you know, think about that, and in Massachusetts, and the Green Bay Packers, because in the 60s when I was a kid growing up, they were the team, the Lombardi Packers, and they captured not just my imagination, but everybody at that point in time. And, you know, I'm one of these fans that, and believe us, all of us that are in sports folks are fans, basically. That's why we got into this business, okay? We're fans. Everybody has a team they followed as a kid, and those were my teams, the Yankees and the Packers. And I always said to myself, you know, this is a great business to be in broadcasting. If I ever had a chance to do either the Yankees or Packers, that's what I would have to do. I would just have to do that. And my career bent was mostly toward football early on, and that's where I, you know, kind of – I did the Cubs for a few years, but, you know, my job was football. And so when the Packers job came up, you know, that was something I was interested in.
Yeah, of course. We're talking with Wayne Larrivee here on The Download. We'll take a quick break, Wayne, if that's okay, and
sure.
we'll come back. I really – Pete and I would love to talk about our producer. We talk about this all the time, how difficult it is in this day and age and how fast the game of football is to size it up on the radio. And I'd love to get your take on how you do that, be able to tell the story of the game as it's unfolding on the radio. So we'll talk with Wayne Larrivee more about the craft of calling a football game when we return. Stay with us. It's a Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight, Wayne Larrivee, the voice of the Packers radio network, and of course, a man who used to broadcast here at WGN Radio, the Bears on TV and the Bulls. We haven't even talked about the Bulls. I mean, what a charmed life, Mr. Larrivee. You got the chance to work with the 80s Bears and then also be able to broadcast some of the 90s Bulls. Covering Michael Jordan and both championships runs, what an experience.
Yeah, it was a tremendous experience. You know, obviously the 85 Bears, but the Jordan Bulls were just great. We broadcast those games on Channel 9, and it was a tremendous experience. I spent, you know, 18 years broadcasting Bulls games, and I've never been with one team longer than that, and they were just great. It was great. The organization was first class. You know, Jordan and Pippen and those guys, Rodman coming in, what a wonderful experience that was.
Now, for you, I mean, I don't know too much about the relationship between players and broadcasters. When you spend that much time with one organization, like you said, 18 years, do you develop at least relationships, friendships with the players, or is it pretty much business where they go one way, you guys go another?
You know, it's interesting. In basketball and baseball, you're able to develop a relationship with players because you're with them so much. You know, there's so many games. Football, it's really hard to get to know a football team. You're restricted on when you can be in the locker room, when you're on the road, and we travel sometimes with the team. You know, you're kind of restricted there, too. The players are in one compartment. The media front office types are in another. So it's hard to get to know a football team, but baseball and basketball, maybe because the fact is that baseball is about a 25-man roster, right. Football or basketball is about a 15-man most roster, you know, you have an opportunity to get to know these people a little bit better. So you do, over the course of the season, get to know these guys.
Do you feel, I mean, obviously as a broadcaster for a team as opposed to a traveling, I mean, you do stuff with Westwood and you've done, and you do Big Ten stuff that goes all over and you cover different places. But as the relationship, as the media has changed and evolved and social media has come into play, do the players, are they still sort of on the up and up with your relationship? They're like, hey, Mr. you know, Wayne Larrabee, that kind of thing. Or are they a little bit more guarded around the media because they just don't want to trust anybody who's got a microphone?
I would say they're a little more guarded. You know, I mean, social media has replaced the microphone as kind of the sound box. And, you know, people have to be careful of what they say and who they say it to and that type of thing. But, no, I think players, it's interesting. I think I say to myself, you know, I don't know if these players even know who I am. But players are more aware than we give them credit for, and they know who's who in that locker room and on the plane, and on the buses, and that type of thing. So they know us, and you get to know them. Again, they understand team broadcasters are a little bit different than maybe the newspaper guys or some of the other people who cover the team.
You know, I mentioned before the break just the art of being able to call a football game. But as a broadcaster who goes across, you know, you mentioned you did some stuff with the Cubs, but also 18 years with one team, the Chicago Bulls, and also your experience with football. I mean, is it a stark difference to broadcast in a different sport?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I, for a long time, would do college football on Saturdays on television and NFL football, either the Bears or Packers on Sunday on radio. And, you know, the call is totally different. It really is. And people don't understand why it's different, but television is a cool medium. People can see what's happening, and you're basically framing the picture they see. On radio, you're painting the picture they see. So the inflection of your voice and that type of thing is wholly different from what you do in a telecast. And, you know, sport to sport, yeah, it's different, I think, a little bit. Each sport has its own flow and momentum. Baseball is more conversational. Football is a lot of, you know, okay, here we go. You know, you can tell first and 10, they're at the line of scrimmage, that type of thing. And then the play happens.
Just hearing you say that, it makes me giddy.
Yeah, and then basketball is you know, up and down, back and forth. And it's a great challenge, but each game has a different call.
It's amazing to me, and like I said, Pete and I were having this conversation just about how intricate and delicate and complicated a football call at the line of scrimmage is. I mean, what you do first and 10, even listening to a little bit of the call, the championship game, first and 10, split side, you know, backfield, where the quarterback's at, everything that you have to do to set up a play on the radio, it's intense. I mean, how do you, I guess the question is, as someone who's been in this for so long, when you first started out, how do you get that right?
Well, you know, it's basic, really. Okay, start of the play, you know, first and 10, what down is it? Okay, formation, who is where? Do you have time to mention the running backs, the wide receivers, that type of thing? And then you describe the play, and then you mention who makes a tackle, how many yards they gain, second down coming up 4 yards to go. So, you know, I honestly think play-by-play on the radio is pretty easy because you do have to dominate, and you do have to there are things you have to describe. Being an analyst on radio is really a huge challenge, both in football and in basketball, and most guys can't do that very well. Tom Thayer does it extremely well. Larry McCarron in Green Bay, outstanding, just right. Knows when to jump in, knows how much time to take, knows what to describe. Few guys are like that, though, and again, Thayer is one of the best I've ever worked with. So is Larry. You know, but that's the tough part, the analyst part.
The interpreting what just happened in the play and why it's significant in a short amount of time.
Because the play-by-play guy, he knows what he has to do. You know what you have to do to describe the play to the guy driving along the highway listening on the radio. You know that. So it's almost easier. The analyst has to say something salient in a much shorter period of time.
I've seen more of an appetite as football evolves and obviously becomes such a dominant sport in terms of popularity. I've seen more of an appetite for the specifics. Obviously, from media that's about breaking down defenses, or you see it on ESPN all the time now, where they're using the graphics to show how a cover two beat the pass out of the backfield, that kind of thing. You know, for you, I mean, have you developed that kind of skill to be able to quickly be able to interpret and see what a football play is going to be before it happens?
I have a feel for that a little bit, but generally that's something that the analyst has to handle. That's something the guy who's been there and has done that handles best. And so that's kind of the way I look at it. Yeah, can I kind of sense that and see that, feel that? Yes, but really those are not my lines. The analyst should be doing that.
Right, of course. We're talking with Wayne Larrivee here on The Download. You know, before I let you go, I mean, it's an amazing career to be in broadcast, and you obviously have a huge responsibility, because there's a lot of fans that are hanging on your every word, especially when it comes to radio and you're painting these pictures. Let's talk about emotion. You know, you kind of were, there was a little bit, just following the NFL, that fans were a little bit critical of one of the games last year when there was that Hail Mary to one of the Packers tight ends, and you weren't jumping up and down and screaming and yelling. You just did the call. Talk about your involvement as a play-by-play guy with the emotion of calling your team's game.
Well, the number one thing is you got to be able to see the play, and we were kind of screened as to who caught the football. So that's why I was a little bit hesitant on that play. And I just wanted to make sure I had the right guy catching the football, which eventually I did. But it was hard to see that from our vantage point at that point in time. So, it's funny how fans interpret things. I mean, emotion's a big part of it. And that's a big part of what we do locally. And Joniak does that well with the Bears. And I do that with the Packers. And, that's a big part of the whole thing. But the number one thing when you call a play, especially a Hail Mary play like that, you damn well better have the right guy catching the ball.
Right.
And if you're not sure, you have to hesitate a little bit, and you have to wait until the things clear up and you see who has the ball.
I mean, that really is it with play-by-play. I mean, for a lot of the other, for media, you can kind of recall it or change your mind. But as a play-by-play announcer, you have to be right. There's
well,
really no
room for
that.
I mean, what if I describe that play and go bonkers and have the wrong guy catching the ball?
Right.
How does that sound?
Well, I mean, you've been involved in some tremendous games. The Packers have been competitive for pretty much all the time you've been in Green Bay. But as we wrap up here, tell me about your experiences in Chicago. Do you miss being involved with the teams, with the Bears, the Bulls? Do you miss being the voice of Chicago sports?
Without a doubt. Those were the 14 best years of my life. Chicago is the greatest sports market in America. I've said that many times, said that here, said that wherever I've been interviewed. It's the greatest sports market in America because people care so much about it. And, again, I'm inclined to be a New York guy, okay? But Chicago is the best sports market. To broadcast and to, write in Chicago, that's the ultimate. And trust me, there is no other market, not San Francisco, not L.A., not New York, not Philadelphia, not Boston. None of those markets, and I've been in all of them, is better than Chicago. That's the greatest sports market in America because people care so much about their teams and about the games.
Wayne Larrivee can be heard every Sunday, and it's the Packers, so a lot of Monday nights too. Not so much for the Bears these days, but I can hear it calling Packer games and, of course, his time here in Chicago for covering or doing play-by-play for the Bears and the Bulls. Wayne Larrivee, thanks for taking some time out to talk to us tonight. We appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Justin. Take care.
How about that, huh?
Love Wayne Larrivee.
Guy, so good, man. So many great childhood memories with Wayne Larrivee attached.
Yeah.
You'd get that Channel 9 broadcast of the 90s Bulls, and they'd be like, and this was a day, there were a couple years in there where I didn't have cable. And you'd be like, oh, man, I want to watch his Bulls team, you know, with Jordan. And you'd be like, when you get that Channel 9 broadcast on a Saturday night, it's like, hello, everybody, I'm Wayne Larrabee. I'm like, yes!
Well, for me, the trifecta in Chicago at the time was Larrabee with the Bears, Foley on radio with the Hawks, and Jimmy Durham.
Yeah, right.
With the Bulls.
Absolutely.
Three of the best.
Chicago's blessed in that regard. I mean, there's some great people. We still do. Yeah. I mean, I do like the Bears radio. I like the Bulls. I love Stacey King.
Oh, they all do
Stacey
a good job. No, I'm not trying to malign anybody.
No,
they do
I'm
a good job. I'm just for me.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's like, I you know, there's days that you kind of miss that. You'd love to have that sort of connection, you know, that sort of memory connection to Wayne Larrabee and what he did for broadcasting the 85 Bears.
The way Larrabee calls games is what I kind of modeled myself after when I was calling Alouettes games up in Montreal.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There you so. Go. Would you jump up and down if they got a goal?
I almost passed out one time when they scored a touchdown. Anthony Calvillo was the quarterback, and I think he hit one of the running backs over the middle, and the guy deked and ducked and you know, scored a miraculous touchdown, and I yelled so loud that I started getting lightheaded. And Ed Filion, former defensive tackle for the Alouettes, looked over at me and goes, on the air, dude, you okay? I said, yes, the Alouettes just scored.
We need to find that tape.
I've got it.
You've got it? Oh, man, come on. We should do a new segment where Martyr replays some of his greatest...
I'll dig it up for him.
...play-by-play moments. And you could do like a play-by-play of the play-by-play. Do a whole thing. Anyway, Wayne Larrabee, that was great. So fun to have Wayne Larrabee on the show here. The Download 720 WGN, Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Greg Allen's going to be here, famed neo-futurist. That sounds so political. The famed, if not political, then very intellectual. The famed neo-futurist will be with us. Greg Allen is the creator and founder of the Neo-Futurist Theater Company. Up in Andersonville. They've been doing Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind for decades, since 1988. That's crazy. Rite of Passage, really, when it comes to theater in Chicago, a late-night show that is 30 plays in 60 minutes, and a must-visit for anybody who's coming to Chicago, moving to Chicago, or coming of age. It was a great place. I went as a college kid. I was like, how cool am I? And I'm sitting on the floor. I remember I brought someone from McHenry. Like I was living in Chicago, and someone that I had, a girl that I was after, who was maybe in high school with me, who is now after. I'm like, yeah, you should come to Chicago and visit. I'll take you to the theater. I would just go to the coolest theater ever. It's so complicated theater. You're going to love it. They just play themselves on stage. You're going to love it. They jump up and grab a number. You're going to love it.
I think that place really subsists on college age dudes bringing every new girlfriend they have to that place.
Well, you know, it's all ages, so that's one. So you don't have to like. There's one thing about bringing, you know, dudes bringing college age girlfriends to Chicago and being like, okay, let's just try to get in this bar. That could go wrong, and you're like, I guess we'll just walk around. So the neo-futurist in Too Much Light, they gave you that option to be like, look how cool I am. You want to go where there's a line, babe? There's a total line over here. I got to know those guys. You know, John Pearson, who's been on the show, is also the guitar player from Screeching Weasel.
Great.
Rachel Claff, and Dinah Slickman are great. I mean, there's so many people that I know from Dave All, Dave Kadesky. So many great, and I'm missing a million people on this, obviously, friends of mine who... over the years, it became an honor to be able to collaborate with them, to converse with them. We were in Scotland at the same time with them. So I got to know their aesthetic and what they were about. And there's some great, creative, good people in Chicago. And they've been teaching theater, performing theater, doing theater the right way here for decades. And it's really fun to watch that theater company evolve. Because it used to be that, you know, it was that crew, and they would, you know, Dave Aul would come in, Phil Ritterelli would come out. You know, like, it was, that was the idea. And they've added so many young voices to the company. And now if you go see a Too Much Light show, none of those guys are in it. And it's all a new cast, and it's great because you're like, this is how it should be. This is the rebirth. So we will talk with Greg Allen about that as he continues to push for Too Much Light to be in other cities. There's a New York Neo-Futurist. There's a San Francisco Neo-Futurist. At one point, I believe there was an Atlanta. I could be wrong on that. There was a they were doing it in Nashville. Montreal is another one.
Wow.
They've been in Europe. So he's continued to take this show, this 30 plays in 60 minutes kind of concept, to other markets and be successful with it. So we'll talk with Greg Allen coming up after 9 o'clock. And tonight, the worst. Excited about that. TJ Jagodowski, who has been on the program a few times. He's played the worst. Yep. Yeah. Abby McEnany as well.
Great.
So they will be in studio with us, where we will be complaining about the worst things in society for prizes. What do we do? What do we got? Good stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, look,
good ones. Yeah.
Ooh. Looks like we got a Pequod's pizza gift card. Always good. A MyPillow. Can't beat the MyPillow. I mean, that's what I said. I mean, you come up with a joke at 312-981-7200. Are you saying, not even a joke. You know what's the worst? The worst is when, oh, man, when I chip my nail. And we could be like, that's good enough. We'll give you a pillow. Where else in the world are you getting to complain, and then you get to win a new age, technologically advanced pillow?
Nowhere.
No, I can almost say that for certain.
Uh-huh.
I'd have to do a little Google searching because I'm not sure if that's, you know, let's make sure we fact check that. But I don't think there's anywhere else in the world that does that.
Love it.
Also, that was great to have Wayne Larrivee. Some programming updates for us here at WGN Radio. We'll be back with some of the post game with OB and Hampton. We'll be back for post games for the Bears this fall.
Best
great.
In the business.
And here on the download, I'm very excited to announce that Doug Plank, good old number 46, who's been on our program a couple times now in the last couple months, we've enjoyed it. We've had good chemistry, and Doug's going to join us on Mondays after games. Isn't that great? It's going to be like, I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like that's so, like, awesome Chicago.
That's the greatest.
I'll fake it up right now. Ready?
Every Monday after the Bears game, he's going to come on and talk.
And I'll be like, another disappointing Sunday. They ruined my Sunday, Doug. What are you doing wrong? And then he gives you the goods, and I just complain. Or they win, and I say, I told you. I said 13-3.
Right,
that's
13
what I
and
said.
3.
13 and
are you 3. Are you holding to that?
You know, the only problem I have with that is I do hold to that at 13-3 because I believe in this Bears team. I really do. I like Vic Fangio, and I like the defense. I think the defense can be really, really good with Danny Trevathan and the linebackers that they assess. Who always gets in the way of my 13-3 is Jay Cutler. Always. Every year I'm like, this is it. This is the year. And it's Jay Cutler that gets in the way.
Why?
I remember with the Lovie Smith. I mean, Lovie Smith got fired after a 10-6 season where they started 7-1. And a lot of that, Jay Cutler.
Wasn't that when Jay Cutler was hurt?
Yeah, exactly. And then Jay Cutler gets hurt.
So
and
not
he comes back.
Just not based on his play.
There was
play
a couple games in there where you're just like, oh, it's so maddening. And then it's like, oh, we're so sick of Lovie Smith. And then Trestman comes in. Oh, so sick of Mark Trestman. John Fox is going to go 7-9. So sick of John Fox. He'll be gone after the year, Jay Cutler. I saw an article. They're already talking about that. Next year his contract comes up. Or it doesn't come up, but it escalates up. So he's worth $15 million or something like that. And they're already saying that's too expensive. So he's got to have like a playoff year to be able to justify the Bears paying $15 million for that position. Although that's kind of cheap when it comes to quarterbacks.
Yeah.
But still.
I mean, I don't – he can have – I'm hoping for a Hall of Fame career from Jay Cutler, and he can get whatever amount he – I don't care what he gets.
Like you're hoping that it's a Peyton Manning kind of situation. Come back for 1 year. We'll pay you the whatever we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's hard to believe that – we've been talking about this since, what, 2008? Is that when he came in? 2009?
Somewhere around there. I remember it being so excited.
Maybe it was 2011. There was 1 year that they weren't very good. And then the second year, 2011, they went to the NFC Championship game, and that's where he pulled his my leg hurts. And that so maybe it's somewhere it's like 2010. Ugh. 6 years.
I have a good feeling about this Bears team as well. I think I'm I don't know 13-3, but 12-4, somewhere 11-5, playoff caliber team win at least a game in the playoffs. It's going to be a great fall, great early winter.
Yeah, I hope so. The ESPN guys, they did a thing. I watched NFL Live today. They weren't showing Reba, so I switched over to NFL Live. And they did a pre-thing where it was like worst to first. Are there any teams in the NFL that could go worst to first, that they finished last in the division and now they have a chance for first? So they went each division.
Yeah.
They went to the NFC North and they talked about, they go, what about the Bears? And they went to these guys, you know, former safeties, you know, like, I don't even know who's working in NFL coverage for ESPN these days. And, you know, every you know, half-assed safety from the 90s is a analyst, you know. You're like, oh, you were great. Anyway, they're like, let's turn to Darren and Troy. And they're like, and they started laughing. They like started laughing. The Bears, can they be worse to first? No. And they both started laughing, and they're like, no way. Not even close.
Why? What?
They said that they just don't have the horses in Chicago to compete with teams like Minnesota and Green Bay. They said even the Lions have more talent than the Bears do. And frankly, you know, they just don't have what it takes right now. And their best player they let go in Matt Forte. And this team... is just not ready for prime time. And I was like, you know what? I'm not buying that.
I'm not buying it either. I mean, the Vikings they're going to be okay. The Bears will be better than the Vikings. Packers, that's always going to be trouble. But
it could be my Chicago bias. There's no doubt. But when I was thinking, I thought this when I was walking away from the television set after I threw it to the ground, and I was like, maybe I'm just not understanding, but. The Packers have been able to transcend from my childhood memory of them as wash-up losers to successful team that is always around because they had 15 years of success, right? They're able to shift my sort of thought prep pattern on the Green Bay Packers. The Minnesota Vikings and the Detroit Lions have not. There's nothing in their histories that made me go, that's a winning organization,
no,
the Vikings. You know, so I'm like, and it could be a bias. It could be a block in my mind. It's like everybody in the NFL is like, the Vikings are the real deal with Adrian Peterson and Teddy Bridgewater, and they got all the pieces in place. But I'm like, nah, ain't having it. I'll see that game in November when they're losing 48-10. And, you know, what's wrong with this Vikings team? So I don't buy the Vikings. Don't buy the Lions at all. And I think that at some point or another, you're going to see some regression from the Packers because they can't take steroids anymore. Matthews and Peppers, they can't take steroids anymore. That, you know, they're on the PEDs. So, you know, now they'll be half of the players they were. Rodgers will be like, man, I don't care anymore. And they'll go 6-10. We'll go 14-2.
Learned something very sad this morning. Jordan Rodgers, Aaron Rodgers' brother, who was a contestant on The Bachelorette, on the current season of The Bachelorette. He's estranged from the family.
I read that. That's what someone asked him, like, what's it like to be brother? He's like, well, we don't really talk. So I'm like, oh, well, you still got what it takes. You're a Rodgers. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. Stay with us. We welcome the return of Teddy Roosevelt, presented by Konasek and Dillon Trial Attorneys this August 13th at 10 a.m. at the MAC at the College of DuPage. Join WGN Radio and John Williams in a conversation with the 26th President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt. You want bold, bombastic, bravado? That's our guy, TR. I always think I'm Matthew McConaughey at that point. I'm like, that's our guy, TR. All right, all right, all right. It's 2016 and perhaps one of the most important years in U.S. presidential history. We're here to discuss what was, what is, and what may be to come. And we're starting it all off with Teddy Roosevelt. Tickets to the return of Teddy Roosevelt are on sale now. Go to WGNRadio.com/events to get all the information there to buy your tickets online or over the phone. These shows do sell out, so don't wait to get your tickets. See you on Saturday, August 13th at the College of DuPage. The return of Teddy Roosevelt's presented by Konasek and Dillon Trial Attorneys and sponsored by Visit Springfield and transportation provided by O'Hare Midway Limousine. All right, coming up, Greg Allen's going to come up right after the news here at 9 o'clock. If you're interested in the All-Star game, the All-Stars right now from the American League are beating the All-Stars from the National League 4-2 in the fifth inning. And Quintana just got a big strikeout.
I don't know.
I didn't get a chance to see. It looked like there were a lot of guys on base, though. So, Chris Sale, they pitched him one inning. He was gone.
Yeah. I saw Paul Sullivan retweeted the White Sox. Did you see the White Sox had tweeted out Chris Sale, you know, Chris Sale All-Star game performance, one inning, nine pitches, 1K. Totally.
Just ignoring the Chris Bryant also hit a home run. Yeah. I'm okay. I mean, All-Star games, I guess, are fun. And they used to be – they're just so frustrating as a fan, too, because you watch them and you're like, this guy. And then you're like, he's done. Are you an All-Star game guy?
No. I mean, I was when I was a kid, and it really bugs me that the game counts.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that – I agree with you. I think that ruins it. I don't know if they're maybe the marketing people and the ratings people, advertising people will tell you differently. Maybe there was no interest in the All-Star game in the 90s, and people are like, oh, they're taking off. Jim, what do? Jim? We need to make it count. Because, frankly, I kind of like the idea that you got represented to this honor. It was kind of great that you get to play against the best of the best, and it's just fun. And it added a little bit more fun to it. You might have these moments where Cal Ripken gets a switch and do all this kind of stuff because you're not worrying about winning or losing. Making this count makes it a boring mid-season baseball game.
It counts, but like to the managers, it doesn't really count because Chris Sale, arguably the best pitcher in the American League, would not only pitch one inning if the game,
right?
You know, like why is he not playing five innings?
Right. Why not pitch your best guy six innings?
Yeah.
Jose Fernandez should be in there pitching four innings, right? Yeah, and you're right. It's absolutely right. The idea that it's foreign to have a starting pitcher pitch one inning.
Is Bud Selig alive?
Yes, but he's stepped down.
Yeah, because I was. Yeah, because it's a new. There's a new, there's guy, a new guy, Rob Manfred,
maybe.
But because I think that. I want to say that maybe they're friends, like the new commissioner is friends with Bud Selig, because I think that this will eventually change. I think they're going to change this back to just a regular game, but I think that they're doing it out of respect to Bud Selig, that they're not, because he came up with that, you know, after that tie game, whatever, what year that was.
Yeah, right. This is like, Bud, you got great ideas. You've always had great ideas, Bud. He's like, well, thank you.
Yeah.
We're just going to keep it, Bud. Thank you.
Yeah.
We're not going to keep it.
Right. I think that's going to change. I mean, it's fun. It's fun. You know, obviously this year I'm a Cubs fan. It's fun to see, you know, all the Cubs on there.
Have they done anything tonight?
Other than Bryant, I haven't really seen. I saw Addison Russell 0-for-2. Chris Bryant, I think, made an error. Or maybe it was a difficult play. But
it's the All-Star game. They're all difficult plays, Pete.
That's right. Damon Wayans. They're showing all the people that are coming up on the Fox shows. there's the guy from Bones. Yeah,
have not aired yet. That's what I love about that, too. It's like, David Wayans is going to be on the new show Spot Start coming up this September about a relief pitcher turned investigative journalist. Spot Start, Tuesdays at 9.
You know, they do that at this time of year. That's
at least in the football season when they do that. It's usually later in the season. And you're like, okay, that show's been on for a little bit. So you're like, now it's like the hit of the, and look at that. Don Thompson from the hit show Prison Break.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, right, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the ones we haven't seen yet.
Yeah, World Series time, October. You know, that's when you see everybody. They stick David Boreanaz in the why is he? Well, he's not a Cardinal. He's not a Royals fan.
Yeah, Cusack comes in with the Sox hat on.
And I also don't like and I know it's part of the synergy, the corporate synergy. But like when the Cubs are on ABC, you know, you get Rob Elgus sits in with Len and JD for an inning. And I love Rob Elgus.
Does he
say
what's coming up in the news? Is that what they're doing?
I think they just, they want to promote, they want to promote the news on Channel 7. Now, I like Rob Elgus. I like, I like ABC News, but it's just weird to have, I feel like Len and JD. It's kind of like when they had to like bring in a bad seventh inning stretcher for the couch portion, and it was like nobody interesting. Let's welcome the, you know, the high school volleyball champions from Benedictine High School.
Well, it's the guys from Million Dollar Quartet. They're here tonight again. They were here 2 months ago. Good to see you guys. I still don't understand. I saw something where they're doing a campaign, like a fan campaign. You can like submit your seventh inning stretch tape. You know, it's like a thing that
yeah.
Was like, so I don't understand what their problem is with not letting Dorothy, 90-some-odd-year-old Dorothy, yeah. sing the national anthem. Everybody wants Dorothy to do it. They did a petition and everything. They want to do it. So are they opening it up so they can have an excuse to give it to Dorothy? Or are they doing it almost to spite? I don't understand why they just don't let the old lady sing the damn seventh-inning stretch.
Yeah.
Let her get up there and do it. It would make it. I swear, every time I go watch one of the games, the seventh inning is like, gosh. Okay, you get your stars that are there every single year, which is Cubs fans who are Jeff Garland and Jeremy Piven.
Sure.
Those, we get it. Okay, but those are few and far between. You know, so I just would like to see MLB. I would like to maybe we go above the Cubs. Maybe we take Dorothy's petition. If you remember, Dorothy was on. She came on the show. She did the big table where she talked about being a Cubs fan who's been on the first base line for years.
Mm-hmm.
She's had a season ticket since the 80s.
Yeah.
But she's been living in Chicago since, you know, in the 60s, 50s. So anyway, the idea that she, as a lifelong Cubs fan who's always up on the first base line, why not give an iconic woman who everybody knows when they come to the park, they're like, oh, yeah, there's the fan.
Yep.
There's the...
See her on TV.
They show her on TV all the time. So... Stu over at the Club 400 had the idea to get Dorothy to do the seventh inning stretch. They did the petition. It got a lot. It went viral. Every media outlet, including us, picked it up. And the Cubs just didn't do anything about it.
So we go White House?
I'm saying first you go to – I'd say we go to MLB. We should have gone to San Diego. We made a mistake. Tactical error.
Just go to Tom Tunney.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
He's got so much pull with the Cubs.
I mean – Hey, Alderman Tom. We're going to go right after him.
We'll go right
Only beer and wine.
It's Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, a new season for the Neo Futurist was announced this month. The longtime theater company is behind Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, the Chicago staple that holds the record for longest running stage show in Chicago history. It first took the stage on December 2nd, 1988. The company and the show were the creation of Greg Allen. Allen's busy today making the Too Much Light brand worldwide with spinoffs in New York, San Francisco, and Montreal. We'll talk about Montreal. It's half Montreal. Mm-hmm. Just to name a few cities. Greg's one of the great theater treasures here in Chicago, and the theater company continues to do great, creative, diverse work that's recognized by critics and audiences worldwide. Greg Allen is my guest tonight in studio. Greg, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Good to see you.
Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, it's interesting to be a founder and to be part of the company. I mean, obviously, you've been there from the beginning, but you're not really involved with the Neo-Futurists.
Right? Yeah, not so much. I pretty much teach classes through the Neo-Futurists and kind of advise them, but kind of have expanded my career elsewhere and really kind of focused more on taking Neo-futurism, if you want to give me the ism, worldwide, and trying to influence theater makers around the world.
When you do that, I mean, obviously the success of Too Much Light, everybody in Chicago knows. I mean, Pete and I were talking about being college kids and coming through. Are you afforded that luxury of everybody knows it's a great product before it comes to another market? So, I mean, so when you started, New York's 12 years, but let's take a San Francisco. I mean, is there already a reputation for the show before it gets there?
Not really. Usually we expand to a new market when we've toured there. So like we toured New York every year for maybe 5 years before we actually opened a branch there. San Francisco, we've been to a number of times.
Right.
And so, you know, there is some word of mouth, even if we've gone pretty much when we've toured ahead of time, because we've toured quite a bit.
Right.
So that kind of plants the seeds.
Why make the move to a San Francisco, to a New York? Because people are interested in it? Because there are people who want to launch theater companies in those towns?
Well, yeah. I mean, Usually it comes from a neo-futurist moving to that city who then calls me and says, hey, I really want to start a branch here. So, I mean, it really is someone who has gone through the training and knows the aesthetic and the format and the policies and all that. And through one way or one reason or another winds up wherever they are and decides to start a branch there. So New York was a little different in that it was a venue that called us and said, hey, come be our show in this venue. And then we left that venue after a year anyway. it was a problematic venue out in Brooklyn, which was interesting. But, you know, now we're down in the village. And
ooh, look at you.
And yeah, yeah.
Should have stayed in Brooklyn, huh? You guys could have been the hipster theater company.
I totally thought Brooklyn would work, but that space would not. So so we're very happy at the Crane in Soho or in the village. And yeah, it's working out. And doing other shows as well. I mean, always doing other work.
Well, let's talk about your work. I mean, obviously, you know, you've been in this town for decades now doing theater work with Neo-Futurist, but also other places. I mean, you've matured in your career where you're not just part of, you know, doing shows above the funeral home.
Right.
On Ashland. I mean, you're working with the Goodman, the MCA, other places. Talk about where you want to go as a performer.
My goal for this decade of my life, of my career, was really to direct plays I hadn't written and write plays that someone else directed. So to try to, I've always been a theater creator who writes, directs, and performs
right.
pretty much his own stuff. I was happy to let the performing part of that go because I've never been too comfortable, thrilled. It's always been my least favorite part of making theater is being on stage.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Just not for me, really.
That's so hard to, I mean, I can understand like growing out of it because, but I mean, when you think of you and the beginnings and the too much light life that was Belmont and Clark or Live Bait or yeah. moving up. I mean, you're the face that's grabbing the number off the clothespin.
Yeah. It was always my least favorite part of it, really. I'm too much of a control nut to really throw myself completely into the craziness of 30 plays in 60 minutes. I mean, I created Too Much Light to train myself to deal with whatever was thrown at me in the moment. And I mean, that was fairly successful. But ultimately, it's the crafting of exactly what I want to say to an audience that always inspires me the most, as opposed to the chaos of being on stage that night.
So for you, I mean, you moved into that direction in your career. You got off stage and you're working behind the scenes or directing.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Right after I stopped performing Too Much Light after 25 years, which is a long time when you think about it, I was part of the playwrights unit at the Goodman, and so commissioned to write a play at the Goodman, commissioned to write a play for DePaul, and then I started directing at the Goodman and other places around town. And so, you know, trying to really my goal, I mean, really my goal at this point in my 50s is to be a regional theater director. And also I was going to these festivals. I was teaching at like down in Louisville, Actors Theater of Louisville, or I teach at the O'Neill, the National Theater Institute, which hosts the National Playwrights Conference. And I was going to these places and they were all, you know, all hail the playwright. The playwright is everything, the be all and end all of theater art. And I just don't buy that. I think it's like a playwright is a piece of what you do. And so I kept running up against this, oh, well, I'll hail the playwright, you know, whatever they write, they're number one. So if I can't beat them, I'll join them. So I'm trying to become a playwright and trying to compete on a normal playwright's path and started, with the Goodman Commission and this other commission, I started writing full-length plays that had never been produced. Now, every playwright in the country would kick me for saying I've never had a play that hasn't been produced, but I was always producing my own stuff. So
right, right.
And festivals aren't going to accept anything that's been produced before. So finally I had scripts that hadn't been produced. So I sent them out to contests for the first time and basically won them.
I find it hard. I mean, we'll take a break here in just a second, but I find it hard to believe that you're okay with just being the playwright and only the playwright. I mean, I've known you for a couple of years now, and I know you to be a control guy, and you like good. But I mean, that's you've taught yourself almost in a way as being the aesthetic of the neo-futurists. Is you guys are you guys, and you create it, you direct it, you put it on stage, you do everything DIY.
Yeah.
So it's got to be tough for you.
Yeah. It's I think the hardest thing is to literally write a play, send it to someone. I mean, actually, a company up in Minnesota is doing one of my plays, and I'm debating whether to go or not because I'm not going to direct it, and I already did direct it, you know, and so it's going to be a shadow of what I want it to be.
Without even seeing it. You already gave it a review.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, well, because I know how I want it to be done, and I know it will not be done that way. So it's hard. It's hard.
But that's a big part of theater. I mean, the idea of letting go and almost like letting other people collaborate and be able to put their vision on top of your vision and see what kind of chemistry comes out of it.
Yeah, I let people do that at a distance and then send me the reviews or tell me about it. I don't make me sit in the house and cringe.
Greg Allen's my guest tonight. He's the founder and creator for Neo Futurist Theater Company and as well, Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. My guest in studio tonight, Greg Allen, the founder and creator of Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, the Neo Futurist Theater Company here in Chicago. They have a new season that's starting up in the fall, which we'll talk with the Neo-Futurists because it really is interesting. I mean, when I think Neo-Futurists, I think you, I think Pearson, who was in here, I think Diana Slickman.
Sure.
I know that Rachel's doing some stuff. She's doing the Futurarium that came from the new
Oh, right, the movie readings. Yeah.
And I just think about, and I think Dave All, uh-huh. And I think of that crew of really like the late 90s or mid to late 90s crew.
Yeah.
As you know, just the golden age of Chicago theater. I mean, and pretty much none of those actors that I just mentioned are involved in Neo-Futurists anymore.
John is going to be coming back, I think, this fall, and still he helped me. John Pearson helped me go out and start the New York Neo-Futurists, and helped me go out and start the San Francisco Neo-Futurists. So he's my right hand man.
There you go.
In company creation, yeah.
Well, let's talk about the beginnings of the Neo-Futurists. 1988. I mean, we throw that back, but
I was 12.
Yeah, 12-year-old Greg Allen went to the big bad city that is Chicago. How did you come about to create a theater company in 1988?
Well, I didn't really set out to create a company. I got an offer. I'd worked my way up in Chicago theater by being, you know, a grunt for the bigger theater companies, which at the time were Wisdom Bridge, Remains. Those were the two companies that I really worked for the most as assistant director or what have you. And by making connections at really the highest level of Chicago theater, I got opportunities to perform in and direct and create shows for small companies. So finally I got, I mean, ultimately it seems like finally, I got an opportunity to direct, create a show for Stage Left Theater. And the guy said, kind of, you can do whatever you want to. And I've been kicking around these ideas of Italian futurism and these short plays for a while and kind of developing my own aesthetic. And I said, what if I create a late night show, which in 1988, there was no late night theater.
That's so interesting.
And because Blair Thomas, my friend, had said, you know, in New York, they do theater late. It's like, really? That's crazy.
Red Moon's Blair Thomas.
Because we're always up and looking for something to do. So why not theater late at night? And so I set out to say, okay, what about we'll start a show at 11:15 at night, and I'll make, you know, I wanted everything about it to sound alternative. So the admission was going to be $1 times whatever you roll on a dice to get in. The subtitle would be 30 plays in 60 minutes. We'd perform them in random order. We'd give the audience a menu with all the plays numbered 1 through 30, you would call out the number of the play you would like to see next. There'd be an onstage darkroom timer counting off 60 minutes when the buzzer went off, the show was over. Interactive theater. I mean, in those early days when we were at Stage Left, there were a couple elements that I just loved. One is that we brought every audience member on stage at the beginning of the show. Like, they came in the door and we planted them center stage and interviewed them in front of the audience with a microphone. And so just completely turned the tables on the audience members and made them the performers and then sat them down. We also had a storefront window, which looked out much like your lovely window here, Justin, straight onto Clark Street at Belmont. And people were walking by in droves. You know, the Medusa's was a juice bar that was around the corner. Cafe Voltaire was across the street. Right. The Punkin' Donuts was three doors down. So all these people were you know.
It was part of a, I mean, it was a counterculture neighborhood at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so I would sit there in the window and I'd just freeze, basically. There are different options and a totally different experience as to what I did. If I just was a living mannequin, I just froze, people would go by and it completely flipped people out. They'd look, it's like, is that real? Is that not real? And then the other option is you could freeze, but follow them with your eyes, completely freaked people out. And then other times I would just like take my dinner in there and I'd just eat in the window, you know? And it caused such a stir by doing something so simple, which really makes sense with what we do in Too Much Light. And with neo-futurism in terms of being yourself anyway, that it was amazing how much attention we got just from doing that. I remember a car pulling up. Well, see, we got lines pretty soon out the door, which mm-hmm. always helped, especially on Clark Street. And, you know, a car pulled up and the window rolled down and Amy Morton said, "What's going on in there?" You know, and I was like, "Oh, it's my show. I'm doing Too Much Light." You know, it just caused a stir and starting at 11:15 at night in a random admission, it was cheap. And, you know, it just took off and appealed to young people, which, you know, I was.
I mean,
that was
that's a big part of it. I mean, talk about Belmont and Clark and what that was like in the late 80s, because we hear a lot about it and people know it now. And there's, you know, it's still show. I mean, obviously, you've seen a lot of change in the last 2-3 years. Even the alley is gone.
But, was it gone?
It's gone. But they're making the bill, the huge, there's a huge condo building where the Punkin' Donuts is.
Oh, yeah.
And they're making that a huge thing. Yeah. But I mean, tell us about 1988 in Chicago theater.
You know, the company I left out of my list of the companies I'd worked with was The Organic, which also had a long history with Stuart Gordon, who went on to make Reanimator in Hollywood and all these horror films. You know, that theater, The Organic, was across the street and two blocks north of there. And Medusa's was really, you know, was an underage
all ages club.
Right, and right. So everyone who was under 21 would go to Medusa's. And the Dunkin' Donuts was on the corner and all these punks hung out at the Dunkin' Donuts, hence the Punkin' Donuts. And so we were definitely the symbol of the counterculture. And the amazing thing was kids would drive in from these distant suburbs who were, you know, young punks and probably like the only young punk in Elk Grove Village or whatever, and drive in to see the show. And then, you know, it was just by word of mouth. We never had any advertising. Yes. We never bought into any of that. It was just like people came, saw the show. I'd say to the audience, I'll talk to you before, during, and after the show. And I literally met every single person who came through that door I struck up a conversation with. And through that connection, there was a personal feel of what theater and who these artists were, that people wanted to come back. It was like throwing a party every night.
You know, it's interesting because for the last more recent time, even before the changes of that neighborhood, there still were a lot of punks that would come down to that area and kind of have nothing to do.
Right.
They just hang out. And maybe there is some you know, historical perspective to think about that siblings and friends and generations before came down to come to places like Too Much Light or other things that were there, Cafe Voltaire, other shows that they could see, Medusa's, and it's not there anymore. So so what we see is the big loiter. But at the time, there were things for them to do.
Absolutely. And the annoyance was not far away, and people flocked to that. And, you know, it was really a great time to be doing Chicago theater. And I mean, the other companies that literally started at the same time, Curious Theater, Theater Oobleck, Looking Glass started that year. I think Straw Dog started the same year. I mean, it's amazing how many companies that are still with us started in 88.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think one time, like the late 80s, grabbed so many artists to come in and start a company that have had such lasting impact on Chicago?
Well, one of the things I always tell people of why, you know, people ask me, you know, how Chicago is a theater town. I think it's still true is that Chicago is large enough to support a very large theater community, but at the same time is still affordable enough so that people can come in and not starve to death and still be able to be artists. I mean, I had a bookstore job for 7 years and worked in a cafe and made $10,000 a year for a decade while I started my theater company, you know, and because it didn't take very much money. And maybe today that translates to maybe $20,000. But you can survive here. New York, there's no way right. you can possibly get by on that. Whereas here, you could, you know, especially when you're young, you can hold down a full-time yeah. job during the day and then do theater at night.
It's, I mean, that really is what makes a great theater community, because there is an opportunity to take risk, be creative, yeah. because you can do it on a shoestring budget.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, we literally had no budget. We had no budget for Too Much Light. Because it was just bodies on stage with hand props. I mean, that's it. It was just creativity.
And that's what you mean by neo-futurism. When you talk about the concept, and you mentioned it a couple times, the aesthetic of neo-futurism, explain real quick the elevator pitch on neo-futurism.
Basically, neo-futurism embraces the actuality of who we are, where we are, when we are, so that all the performers are themselves on stage. It's an interactive experience with the audience that can only take place once. We embrace the ephemeral nature of theater. And so it's also a living newspaper where we're holding forth on our own experiences and whatever's going on in the world immediately, right then and there at that time.
So you're not going to pull like number 19 and it's going to be two wigs and a 1920s. No.
And I mean, basically,
hello,
it's,
governor.
It's, yeah,
no, you're not going to get that kind of theater at the New York Theater.
No, not at all. I mean, I kind of say it's documentary theater. It's nonfiction theater. It's non-illusory theater. We don't pretend. You know, a lot of people go, how can you do theater and not pretend? Well, if you see any of my neo-future shows, you'll find out. I mean, we just it's more of a petri dish, a social experiment, an anthropological experiment in who we are, where we are right now.
Greg Allen is the founder of the Neo Futurists, and he's also the creator of Too Much Light Makes Baby Go Blind, which is on stage at the Neo Futurists in Andersonville, Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays. We'll continue our conversation here on The Download. Stay with us. This is Download here on WGN Radio. Justin Coffin, my guest, Greg Allen, the creator of Too Much Light Makes Baby Go Blind, the longest running stage show in Chicago history,
mm-hmm.
also the Neo Futurist Company, also in New York, San Francisco, Montreal. I said at the beginning, half Montreal. Why
half Montreal? They call themselves Les Neo. Well, it's Montreal, right? So they speak French. So they're a francophone company, and they call themselves Les Neos. And they never did Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, per se. They took my teachings of neo-futurism and created other shows were short pieces done in random order. So they did, and they don't have an ongoing 50 weeks of performances, and have done a bunch of great, really, really amazing stuff. So I just brought one of Les Neos down to do my last show at Mariachi. Which was great fun. There was a play by Ibsen called Ghosts. And in the play, there's a maid who's supposedly learning French because the man she's in love with at one point alluded to going to Paris. So in the original play, she's like learning French. So I brought down a native French speaker to play the part. And she was kind of the host for the whole show and welcomed everyone as they came into the show and sat them all down and gave them programs all in French, completely in French. And they would talk to her and she would only respond in French. And so it totally threw the audience off from the very get-go, brought them into this really charming but slightly off environment.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned about how you eat your dinner in a storefront on Clark Street.
Yeah.
That, I mean, there's something about, it's not the right way to say putting off, but to put an audience out of their comfort zone when they walk in the
counteract door. Their expectations. Absolutely. I think one of the inspirations for creating neo-futurism in Too Much Light was really to observing that the world was way too comfortable and that we had expectations that were throwing us off, or I certainly had expectations of what would happen that were throwing me off, and I wasn't very good about responding. And so I really wanted to shake people up and totally surprise them and have them have no idea what was coming next. So we perform the show in random order. You get a random
right.
admission, you get a random name tag, all these things. But at the same time, you know, the material itself is changing every single week, and you think it's going to be a funny show. Well, it's actually quite serious. I mean, there are plays that are very serious. There are plays that are very funny. There are abstract plays. There's political stuff.
Great thing about the Neo-Futurist, at the end of a weekend, you're going to roll the dice on how many plays you're going to replace and write new.
Right.
And that dice can roll at, you know, and be a high number, six or whatever it is. And you're like, ah, geez.
So the experience is, experience is constantly coming at you, and you really don't know what to expect. I mean, which is one of the challenges. Then, of course, you run too much light for 28 years, you know, and it's like people come there with certain expectations. Right. So there are certain rituals that have lasted from almost day one, like the rolling of the die, the name tag, that I would love to subvert and get rid of and just, you know.
You can't, right.
Because people are like, oh, where's the die? You know, they latch on to the... I've always wanted one evening just to have people come in, and they just come in. They don't get name tags. They just come in and sit in the audience. There's one number on the clothesline. Someone jumps up, pulls it down, says, you know, Miss Julie by August Strindberg. And then we just do that play in front of that audience that's expecting.
Why can't you do it?
I've always wanted to do this too. Just switch theaters with another show. So for one night only, I've always wanted to do an April Fool's show, which we've never quite. People are chicken. People are scared. But
who's scared? The companies?
Yeah. I'm much more adventurous than my own company. That's just the deal. So I've always wanted to switch the, like, get another company to come in. There are all sorts of experiments I've always wanted to do.
So, I mean, one of the things I find fascinating about that, I mean, is you're essentially shifting the expectations of someone who's coming in the door.
Absolutely.
And at the same time, creating them. I mean, in the way that, you know, you shifted it so much that it's become not mainstream, but household.
Or tradition.
Tradition, yeah.
Yeah.
And as a performer,
well, that's why
who knows that works, is it...
Well, that's why I've always, I mean... After the first couple of years, my focus was not too much light. I mean, it was really, I mean, I've created 28 other shows for the Neo-Futurists and another 28 shows around town and around the country. And it's always the new project that I am embarking on, something I've never done before. It's like, gee, I've never created a full-length dance piece with no text. I've never created a puppet show. I've never done a solo performance piece that's fully audience interactive with no script. Immersive theater. I did a couple early immersive theaters before there was the word immersive theater. So I really am always trying to do something I've never done before. And that's always been the most exciting thing.
Is that the motivation as your career evolves? Is the motivation what pushes you forward, the idea of doing something new, doing something you've never done before?
I mean, I've always been able to do that. I've always been incredibly lucky that people give me opportunities to take. I've never really had to sell myself. I've never had a resume or a picture or a headshot, any of that stuff. People have just kind of said, hey, come create a show for
us. Right.
What do you want to do? And I've always got a long list, a long laundry list of shows. It's like, well, I've never done that before. That would be pretty exciting. Or I don't understand that. So that's a perfect reason to do a show. You know, at the Goodman at one point, Bob Falls asked me to take part in the giant international Eugene O'Neill Festival there. And he said, you know, Greg, you know, create a show. And he was thinking I would do... I did a show called The Last 2 Minutes of the Complete Works of Henrik Ibsen, or Complete Lost Works of Samuel Beckett as found in an envelope, partially burned in a dustbin in Paris, labeled never to be performed, never, ever, ever, or I'll sue from the grave. Kind of these comprehensive shows, and he thought I would screw around with O'Neill. And so I came back and I said, you know, Bob, what I'd really like to do is Strange Interlude, which is a 9-act 350-page, 7-hour play at the Goodman. And he said, wow, I love, thank God, he said, I love Strange Interlude, but you'll cut it down to about 2 hours, right? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll cut it down to about 2 hours. And then he kind of got cold feet at one point and called me back into his office, and I'm not sure about Strange Italy. And I said, no, Strange Italy is incredible. And the whole thing, we should make the whole thing happen. So we did a 7-hour production of the entirety of Strange Interlude, where I added the stage directions, the character descriptions, the adverbial directives that O'Neill puts in front of each of his lines because he hates actors and doesn't trust them. And so, I really put more of Strange Interlude on stage than has ever been put on stage. And I would say in that way it was more faithful. But at the same time, it kind of made fun of some of the things O'Neill was doing and got hecklers at the Goodman.
Really?
Which was exciting.
Well, I mean, I guess your work has always been that, I don't want to say it's contrary because it's clever and it's unique. I mean, you're not really playing off anything. But there always has been a streak of the neo-futurists and the work that you guys do that you are playing to the height of the intelligence, that there are some things that I don't want to say are beneath you, but you're taking shots at works. And there's love of the playwright, but there's also kind of like, what they did wrong.
I think it comes from a real reverence. I mean, I do think it's an amazing play, Strange Interlude, amazingly and bizarre and preposterous. And I love the work of Samuel Beckett, but I created this, this show with Danny Thompson and Ben Schneider that we've had 11 international tours with it. Or 11 international productions, I should say, that makes fun of Beckett, but at the same time totally loves and reveres Beckett. And so I think people come to my shows and they don't necessarily know what they're in for. Because like when I just did Ibsen's Ghosts at Mary Archie, it was a laugh riot for about an hour and a half, and then it got super Ibsen-y, and I punched them in the gut, and it everyone was crying. So I mean, I love playing with that tone. I love the clash of opposing emotions.
Well, I love the energy of the unknown as a theater goer. I always I want to know that I feel like and why I've gravitated towards neo-futurist work in the past is that you don't know what's coming next as you mentioned before just about expectations, but that's not for everybody. There's probably someone listening right now that's like, I don't want to be toyed with. I don't want to be messed with. I don't want just one play. If I come to see 30 plays
time,
in 60 minutes.
I should clarify, it's audience interactive theater. And so people go, oh, they bring us up on stage and humiliate us. And we never, ever do that. No. It's very much coming from perspective of that we treat people as we want to be treated. We treat the audience as equal or superior to ourselves. And that really is the aesthetic. So, it isn't this kind of horrible, put someone on the spot, humiliate them kind of stuff. And I don't, I mean, I think I have a kind of a passive aggressive stance towards my audiences where I lure them in and entertain them, but at the same time really challenge them and make them think. So,
Greg Allen's the founder and creator of the Neo-Futurists and Too Much Light Makes Baby Go Blind. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. I'd love to get your take on how you start a theater company like the Neo-Futurists today. In Chicago 2016, what would have to be in place for another company to come up and do what you've done here in Chicago? Stay with us. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up at 10 o'clock, the worst, 312-981-7200. This is the weekly segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes.
Wow.
Yeah. You can get a pillow.
A pillow?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. You can get a gift card to a pizza place, a pillow, and pair of tickets to Air Supply.
What's better than that?
And people text in and they tell us what's the worst. And two comedians are in studio with us tonight, TJ Jagodowski and Abby McEnany. I mean, come on, you can't get any better. And it's a lot of fun, and it's coming up here at 10.
It's a rough week for that.
It is a rough week. Well, there's a lot of real worsts.
Yeah.
You get a lot of people who will be like, here's the worst. You're like, well, we're not going to go with that. We'll go with traffic.
Okay.
Give us something about someone who doesn't turn off their signal.
Yeah.
And then we'll get that. So Greg Allen's in studio with me. He's the founder and creator of the Neo-Futurists and Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. You know, as I think about, I kind of teased right before the break about the concept of starting a neo-futurist in 2016. Mm-hmm. You're obviously doing that by going to different cities. But here in Chicago, how would one do that? I mean, I think about the Chicago theater scene. There's a lot of stuff that's up and coming and it's bubbling up and there'll be a lot of young companies. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking for the next generation of neo-futurists, a different theater company that's going to come up and do the kind of things we've been talking about in this hour.
I teach company creation to the MFAs at DePaul. And the number one thing I really emphasize is asking yourself, what is theater and what is your unique vision of theater that does not exist already? Every single company has to have a very vivid mission that is unlike anything else out there. And so I really try to encourage people to write manifestos and dig deep in terms of what do I, how do I see the world? How am I a theater artist? And what do I have to say to the world? And how do I quintessentially create that that would completely express what I'm trying to get
And that's really
across.
What it's all about what you want to say to the world.
Yep, absolutely. People who say, oh, I love this play. Let's create a theater company to do this play. And it's like, yeah, that's not a good enough reason. You know, a good play or a role you've always wanted, not a good reason to create a theater
and
company.
And I mean, we've had conversations, whether it be with musicians or comedians or, you know, even politicians or, you know, people in theater. And it's all the same. I mean, what is your voice? What do you want to say in this world?
Yep.
And you have to sort of think about that before you enter the marketplace and whatever that marketplace is.
Yeah, absolutely. So I, at DePaul and when I'm starting these companies, I really go back to the basics in my classes also. I really start with what sets theater apart from all other art forms. And, you know, and ultimately people come up with the same answers I came up with at 26. And I say, okay, so let's create a company that does that. And I think neo-futurism really embraces a lot of things that are unique to theater that still are seen as revolutionary, which is crazy. I was just teaching a class of 25 theater teachers in New York. They brought me out to teach these other teachers. And I introduced them to my theories of performance. And the teachers were like, well, we can't do that in class. We couldn't do that. Why not? Well, it's way too dangerous. It's just... I mean, asking people about their own lives, that's just too dangerous.
What do they mean by too dangerous?
Well, yeah, you know, they were scared of the chaos of truth, basically. They were scared that all sorts of things would bubble up out of these kids that they'd have to deal with. Well, welcome to my world. I mean, I teach neo-futurism all over the country, and my classes, we laugh and we cry for hours.
But there's something to that. I mean, the idea that as the world gets more complicated, I
Absolutely.
Guess, and chaotic.
Look at what's going on in the world. Everybody needs a voice. And neo-futurism gives people their immediate voice of their personal experience on stage.
For you, I mean, obviously your involvement with writing plays here in Chicago right now and what you're doing with Goodman, MCA, but, you know, puppet shows you got coming up and also the work with neo-futurists. You know, you've got a particular vantage point to be able to sort of look at the state of theater. I mean, are people coming in? Are they creating new voices? Are we feeling that same energy as, say, 1988 when you guys started?
I mean, I think the great thing, if you look at the companies that started in the late 80s, were people who were writing, directing, performing their own stuff. They were very much devising their own work before the word devising was out there. And, you know, I am not as aware, and maybe I'm not as aware as I should be of the young up-and-coming companies in Chicago, but I'm not as aware of as many companies that are creating their own pieces to put up, that instead they're grabbing this play from that playwright, and this New York show did that, and so we're doing that. And I really think, at least in the late 80s and the 90s, it was all about companies that were creating their own work.
And I'd also say creating not only your own work and your own vision, but your own style.
Yeah.
In the way that the Too Much Light show, which still to this day survives and thrives and is a hit and is the longest running show in Chicago history for a reason. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fit in any category. It's not necessarily a show you'd see at the Goodman, and it's not sketch comedy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
very unique.
It's
a
unique show.
I've always been very proud of that, is that people who come to the show, you know, I think of young people who say, well, should we go to a bar? Should we see a movie? Should we go bowling? Or should we see Too Much Light? You know, it's not, gee, let's go to the theater tonight. What should we go see? Too Much Light is such a unique beast. It's like Blue Man or whatever. People, you know, it's a very specific flavor. And it's kind of frustrating for me, is that I've always wanted Too Much Light to be thought of at least within the same realm of theater, but it seems like such an outlier that it really is a unique experience.
Well, it goes back to its roots. I mean, you're in the counterculture capital of the city and in the neighborhood of Belmont and Clark. I mean, it almost was born of the idea of being something different.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean, Yeah, the audience has gotten much more mainstream over the years, which is interesting.
Really?
I mean, those early years, it was punks. I mean, it was really the outcasts of society were coming to Too Much Light. And, you know, I could very much identify with them. And it's interesting to watch the audience kind of change over time and become more mainstreamed.
Yeah. You know, for you and your relationship with the theater company, I mean, obviously, as a founder and a creator of these shows and to not be involved in it, is it challenging for you? Is it emotionally challenging to not have that kind of counterculture vibe that we've just been talking about?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I've got all these other shows going on. I don't really stop and look back and say that. It does make me incredibly proud that there are three, four companies in North America that are promulgating my aesthetic of what theater should be without me having much to do with them. I just went out to the San Francisco company and, you know, I hadn't been there in way too long. I hadn't been there in like 2 years, I realized, to check in with them and meet all the new ensemble members. And, you know, there they were working away and they're all speaking the same language that I created 25 years ago. And we all spoke the same thing. We all knew what was going on. And there was just kind of this room that kind of looked like a theater, kind of didn't. And I was like, oh, I don't know about how this is going to work. And then, you know, the lights went off and the audience piled in and it's like, it's Too Much Light. And here it is. And it's happening. And it was amazing. And it was a great show, you know, and here are these young 20 somethings that I've never met before, basically fulfilling my ideal of what theater is. And so more power to them and more companies to come. That's the really, I've always, my role as founding director of the Neo Futurists is utter world domination. And so that's really what I'm shooting for.
That's the goal.
Utter world domination. There's nothing hard with that.
No.
That's realistic.
It's very realistic.
Yeah.
Life in theater. I mean, for you, you just got a lot. You got a lot left. Obviously, with your work that you're doing at other theater companies in Chicago. But when you think about it, I mean, you have really dedicated your life to the stage, to the art form, to this form of creativity. Do you see it? Could you see it any other way?
I very easily could never have happened. I mean, I was not a theater kid at all. I wasn't someone who was, you know, in the musicals in high school. I never crossed my mind to get near a stage in high school. I was a photographer, you know. I was a kid who worked in the dark and made films and you know, had developer on my fingers. And it was from my interest in photography that led to film, that led to theater as that turned around. But I didn't memorize a line until I was halfway through college. So, you know, I was thought when all this theater stuff dries up, I'll go back to photography. But I guess I've kind of hung that up. which is sad.
Now
it makes me sad.
Right, if you went back to it, you'd be like, oh, this is all digital now?
I know. It's totally ruined. It's completely ruined.
No dark room?
Yeah.
All right, great.
So, and people say, you know, you should go into film because you're such a film guy. And it's like, yeah, I'm a film fan. But like the distance and the time and the... I wouldn't be psyched with... I love the veracity, the immediacy of theater. And that's really my art form.
Greg Allen is the founder and creator of Neo Futurists and Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind. You can see it Friday, Saturdays, and Sundays at the Neo Futurarium, which is up at Ashland and Foster in the Andersonville neighborhood. Also, if you're in New York, go to the Village. If you're in San Francisco, somewhere in San Francisco downtown. Sometimes at Les Neos in Montreal.
Yep.
You can see it all over the place. Yeah. Touring. Greg Allen, great to talk to you. Good to see you, man.
Thanks for having me.
It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. And it is time for the worst.
Yes.
Tuesday night, 10 o'clock. This is where we complain about the worst things in our society for prizes. 312-981-7200. We got great prizes tonight. We've got a MyPillow. I'm serious. You're giving away a pillow. It's kind of the coolest thing ever. Think about it.
Oh, I'm thinking about it, Justin.
Abby, don't get me started. We already did this earlier in the show where I'm like, there's probably nowhere in the world, the radio station, you call in to complain and they give you a pillow.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm going to Google that for the next hour.
Exactly. I need some fact check on that. Abby McEnany's in studio as well as TJ Jagodowski. They are my guests tonight here on The Download. Abby's got a one-woman show. No, is that not good?
No, it's fantastic.
Well, you laugh at your own prop.
Well, you know, it's not my forte, dude.
Right. The audition process is brutal. You cast that thing.
It's called Work in Progress. It's Friday nights at 10:30 at the I.O., not this Friday, but it's running till August 5th, but not the 5th.
August 26th. Right. Yeah, you're fine.
You know
who gives a crap?
It's close.
Jack's
close. Close.
This probably isn't my audience. It's all right.
312-981-7200. Let's get right to it. I love it. People are lined up. They're ready to play tonight. So let's get to it. Before we do that, though, just for the tradition of it, Pete Zimmerman.
Pete kicks it off
every week. So let's go there. Pete Zimmerman, what do you got tonight?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
The Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Just overall.
A bunch of idiot white guys playing bad funk. Stop it for once.
For once. I agree. I wholeheartedly agree.
Thank you. They're the worst.
They are the worst. All right. So there you go. That's a good way to start it off. All right, TJ, what do you got? Why don't we go around, then we'll go to the people here.
All of mine are textural tonight. Because I plan on doing this show a couple of hundred times,
sure.
And so I want to knock off categories and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So my first one that's the worst is when you leave a bar of soap in a wet soap dish, that smag on the bottom side, on the wet side, that
smag.
It goes colorless in your hand, your fingers sink into it and stuff, and it's not soap anymore. It's some other kind of... smag.
Soap
smag.
Soap smag.
That's,
first of
that's
all.
That's the worst. That's the worst.
Ugh.
Unfortunately, that was my nickname in college, but we're not going to talk about that. That's disgusting.
I know, right?
That is, that is the worst.
It is disgusting, and it's very relatable. Everybody knows it, so it works out really well. All right, Abby, what do you got?
I'm every man's worst. You know, I'm these people.
You're the people's worst.
Yes, I'm their voice.
The worst of the people.
The worst is when your granny calls you stupid in the third grade because you can't tell time. That kind of sucks.
That's not.
And I always tell the people the story of that is not that I couldn't tell time in third grade. Okay, let's not. Listen,
that's
it's just
it.
Like,
no.
Yeah, my granny was a tough nut to hoe. Tough road to hoe. How do you
tough nut to hoe. You got it right. No, you nailed it.
We don't know your granny.
That was the worst,
I don't know
Justin.
Your granny. All right. Let's get together. Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, what's the worst, Bonnie?
Hi. Okay, I was fortunate to be at Adele's concert,
the
first one on Sunday. There's the story. I wondered if anybody was lucky enough to get a ticket there.
No, on a budget, station. Bonnie.
Oh, well, so was I. I got the cheapest ticket. I was almost at the very top. Still great. She was phenomenal. But my story leading up to it is what is the worst. Okay, I was in traffic bumper to bumper. I live in Lake Villa, Illinois.
All right.
Bumper to bumper all the way downtown. Get down there. And 2-hour wait to get inside.
Yeah.
They screwed it up.
Was it like security to get in?
Yeah. Well, they're doing construction at the United Center. But the reason, and this is the most important one, and I've been waiting to figure out for a year ago, how to use this story to somehow win your contest for the worst. because it's nobody would believe it unless they knew me. And I swear to God, this is all true. A year ago, almost to the date of the concert, which was the 10th, I got salmonella poisoning.
Uh-huh.
I ended up in the hospital.
That's automatically
for a week.
The worst.
Okay. Well, it took 4 months. I lived on unsolid food. I lost 30 pounds.
All right, Bonnie, we'll give you a
only gained,
pizza.
But that wasn't all.
This lady's, all she's doing is bragging. She's down 30 pounds. She went to see Adele. Life is
she
great. You live in
Lake Villa.
Life's great.
Take it down
for you.
A notch, Bonnie.
There's more. I'm sorry. But
found a great guy.
After that, I had good doctors, very nice doctors. But then I had to go for my mammogram. My mom had breast cancer, and she died of cancer. So it's always horrible, right?
Right.
You girls know how.
Yes.
Okay. But anyway.
Not fun, but necessary.
Oh, man. I'll tell you. Anyway, they found something really suspicious. They tried to get it out two different ways without surgery, and then I finally had to have surgery. Before I had the surgery and went in for an EKG, they discovered I had had a silent heart attack, probably when I was in the hospital.
That might be where the term silent but deadly comes from.
Bonnie, this sounds terrible. Don't then us anymore. I mean, you are going for a record trophy winning.
I did not have cancer. I did not have cancer.
Good.
I did not have cancer, and the blockage in my heart is minor. I did not need surgery.
All right, good.
This was a reward.
Oh, good.
To the day.
Oh, that's nice.
I was so pumped.
And then they screwed it up with construction.
I did not have one drink, and I was so high on life just to be there. I never complained. I didn't, but I thought, this is my is my chance to use my story about the worst.
You nailed it.
You did it. Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you for that story. We appreciate it.
Oh, my gosh.
That's one way to interpret the worst.
Yeah. I think it's
a great story.
It's going a long way, though, to win a prize, to give yourself salmonella, fake breast cancer, give yourself a minor heart problem.
Start construction in Chicago, right?
To get a MyPillow.
All right, let's go to Justin. Justin, you're on the line. What's the worst, buddy?
Oh, what's the worst is, one, I don't think I'm going to win after that, but the second would be...
Just throw in testicular cancer if you can.
I really don't want to throw that in. That's not something I'm planning on today.
All right. Well, if you're not going to go the extra mile, my friend, then someone else sleeps.
Wow, okay.
Someone else gets a nice night's sleep.
No.
I think maybe a good microwave oven might help me out then.
All right, what do you got, Justin?
What's the worst is somebody who's playing Pokemon Go ends up delaying your Metro ride back home for the day.
How did they delay it?
Well, they were waiting right in the opening, waiting in line to get in, and they're trying to catch one and wouldn't let anybody by.
Oh, my God.
What a jerk.
I thought Metro had a whole new Ride Nice campaign. That's part of it. Don't play Pokemon Go when people are trying to get off in Arlington Heights. Jeez.
Ride Nice, not ignorant. Am I right?
And
the Pokemon people better make sure they don't put any ride on the tracks.
Yeah, right. That's what it feels like.
Yeah,
chasing a Pokemon on the Metro train at rush hour.
Also, Pokemon? I don't know. Live text it to me. Live text it.
Live
I'm not on social media. Just live text it. Snail mail it to me. I don't know.
Abby and TJ in studio with me. All right. Playing the worst. There's a lot of people on the line. Stay on the line. James, Joe, also Pam. Stay on the line. We'll get to you just in just a second. 312-981-7200. Stay with us.
It's going down.
312-981-7200. Abby McEnany and TJ Jagodowski in studio with us tonight. Abby's got a one-woman show, Work in Progress. I don't understand the laugh.
Well,
is it not real?
No, it is real. But TJ is actually showing me that when the red light means on, it means that we're on the air. You guys...
So you're laughing. You're laughing at your own plug. It's probably the first time in history somebody is laughing off their own plug.
She's shy
She's
about
shy.
It.
I am. I'm
She's
shy.
It's a one-woman show called Work in Progress. Friday nights at 10:30 at I.O. Not this next Friday. Running through August 26th. Check out the website. All right. Let's... 312 says the worst is following Bonnie.
It's rough, man.
But Bonnie's all right, man. She's doing good.
That was a good story.
It was minor. She got to see Adele. Some people would consider her already a winner.
Yeah, she treated herself.
Yeah, and she's got her health.
And she has a great attitude, man.
Yeah. All right, let's keep going. Let's go to James. Just throw an in fact in there and then I cut you off.
It's classic Justin and McEnany, guys. Justin and McEnany sitting in a tree. I don't know.
James, what's the worst, James?
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Good. How about you,
James?
Good. I'm great.
So, well, not actually. I'm driving home from Chicago, and I'm north of Milwaukee, and it's a traffic zone, so it's really slow, and I'm behind what I can only hope is a cattle truck from the smell. That sucks. But anyway, that's not even why I'm calling. So let's talk about the soap smeg for a second. What's worse than soap smeg on your fingers is when you don't realize you have it on your fingers, and it drops on your shirt. Then it becomes schlar, and You've schlarred yourself.
You schlarred yourself. That's good.
We may have a business starting here, my friend.
That's not the thing, though. That's not my worst. Here's the worst. Okay, so the worst is when you work with idiots. So I have a supervisor. Yes.
Is this you from work? Oh, gosh, darn it. Why are you talking about me in front of everybody? Darn it.
No, stop now.
Okay, keep going, Jim.
So there's a supervisor and a manager. The supervisor's an idiot, so he goes to one of these self-help or self-motivational things that happens at the Motel 6 donut room, you know? And he comes back, and he's coming up with all these harebrained ideas for improving our company, right? Mm-hmm. So I go into my boss, and I'm complaining. I just can't stand it anymore. I'm like, you've got to stop this guy. He's gonna really screw up the company, right? And I give him, he says, give me an example. So I give him an example, and he kind of laughs, and I tell him another example. But I get to the third example, and I'm halfway through the worst example, and I realize that it was my boss's idea.
What did he say?
So I kind of try to talk my way out of it at first, and then I just go, well, okay, screw it, and then I just laugh.
Good job, man.
But they haven't fired me yet, so
well, that's
I guess
good.
I'm
you're
okay.
in.
That was like your 360 review. So actually, yeah. You saved everybody a lot of time. I'm actually very impressed.
Does good, James. Thank you, buddy. Thank you for that. Okay. That's good. I like James.
That's some good ones tonight, man. Yeah. People are bringing the heat.
Quality. That's what happens when you get a good one at the top with Bonnie. Now everyone's like, I can go after this.
The bar has been raised.
All right, let's go to Joe. Joe, what do you got, Joe?
Well, I work contract security.
Okay.
And I'm sick and tired of these teenagers taking things that don't belong to them.
Yeah. Theft. Common theft, we're talking?
A little boy's birthday present of $375 was taken from him. And he is totally distraught.
Oh, man, that's terrible.
Where was it taken from?
I can't go into details. It's under investigation.
Joe, how do we know it was exactly $375? Yeah.
I saw the receipt.
Oh, what was it?
A hoverboard.
Oh, hey, that could have been just some concerned citizen keeping this kid from self-immolating. Right. Those things go up at the drop of a hat. Those
they
things
could have
burst
been for their own good. Yeah.
Was this Russell Crowe? Kids,
we're not going into details here, but that,
we're not allowed to.
Being a grandparent, I am just furious.
Yeah,
that somebody would take a kid's board out of his garage and just disappear with it.
Wow, Joe, thanks for that.
That is
very specific.
Yeah,
worse.
Well, not super specific.
It's tough.
Not super specific. Yeah. You're right.
It's tough without details because you can kind of say the worst is when you know that happens to somebody. You know, like then it's so general that like you have to agree, but you can't agree wholeheartedly because you're not entirely certain about what happened.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh, I love it. All right, let's go to Pam. Pam, what do you got, Pam?
I'll try to make it short, but to me, the worst is that intense phone conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Where while you're still talking, you haven't realized that there's no one on the other end, and they either hung up on you, or you hope they were cut off or hung up on you at least 5 minutes early.
That's great.
And all the profundity goes out of your soul.
Yeah, you thought you had shared all that, gotten all that off your chest.
And it's like, hello?
That's so good. That's so good. Pam, that's so great.
That is
Thank
great.
You.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That's a good one. Pam's got a good one.
Leader in the clubhouse.
Yeah.
Leader in the clubhouse, Pam, I think, right there.
There's so many. And then when you get them back on the line, you're like, where did it cut off?
What'd you hear last?
Did you hear the part about my divorce? No, you haven't? Okay, all right, well, Well, let me back it up.
Rev up that emotional momentum again.
Or if they said, yeah, you say, you know what? Me and Johnny are doing fine. You are a liar. And then, oh, man, there's so many levels.
You can trick them in so many ways, right?
Can we go back to that donut room at the Motel 6? Where is that exactly?
Show me this donut room.
I don't know. Where's the donut room? Just, you know, asking for a friend.
Guide me to this donut room, will you?
There were a lot of questions about the donut room.
For
a lot of good stuff. A lot of information on the worst tonight. Let's go to Patty. Patty, what's the worst, Patty?
Hi, how are you? This happened recently. This is so gross, I thought. I was at a place where they make omelets and eggs for you, right, you know, over the counter. You can watch them. Mm-hmm. So I ordered two eggs over easy. And to test if my two eggs were done, she stuck her fingers on the yolk.
Get out.
And I just looked at her. I was shocked. And she said, she didn't think she was so, you know, I should be so shocked. So she said, well, I just washed my hands. And later I thought, well, what did you do? Just go to the bathroom? And that's why you washed your hands? I couldn't believe how she tested my
crazy.
Egg.
That's crazy.
Okay.
That's the worst, Patty. You have found the spirit of this game.
Yeah.
That is right in the wheelhouse.
Yeah, you're zoned up, Patty. Okay. You are zoned up.
Now,
tonight.
Tell me this didn't happen in the Motel 6 donut room and we're cool. Patty, that is the worst.
No, but it was someplace around here.
Right. Okay. Hey, Justin, I've got a quick question for Patty.
Rob's got a question
for
Patty.
Were the fingerprints left in the yolk as well?
Oh, yeah.
You know how sometimes you touch things and you can still see the fingerprints?
Yeah.
Well, she went and made two more eggs. God knows if she even made two more eggs and she's brought out the 7 months. Oh,
wow.
My God.
It's like someone testing your blister.
Oh, my God. Gross. Yeah, TJ. Oh, my God. You put that on your textural stuff.
And do you mean when you say a place where they make you eggs and- like a diner?
Can I? I'll give it a general.
No, don't. You know, we don't need a name. Need a name. You're talking about a restaurant.
I'll just say, no, it wasn't a restaurant. It was a casino.
Oh, okay. So you're there early.
I know where you're talking about.
All right. Okay. Did you? Well, and a texter just asked, did you eat the eggs or what?
Well, like I said, she said she'd make new ones, of course, and I don't know if she brought up the same ones. She came back late with two new ones.
So good.
Oh my
Patty,
God.
Thanks for that. That's great.
Yeah, only after she handled a stack of 20s.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So everything in that place is filthy. The machines, the chips, the money.
That's
she's
so
pawing.
Good.
She's pawing your overeasies.
So
oh, man.
Oh, come on. All right, let's take a break. We will continue with the worst. This is so good tonight. I didn't even get to the text yet. TJ and Abby are here. We'll continue the conversation. Not really a conversation at all. It's just a game show that's giving us the worst things in our society for prizes. The prizes tonight, Pequod's Pizza, My Pillow, and a pair of tickets to Air Supply, which I know you're after,
Laying
Abby.
Alone, my head on the phone, thinking about you till it hurts. Was that even close?
It was close. It's a download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. A lot of great stuff coming through tonight on The Worst. 312-981-7200. Abby McEnany in studio with me, as well as TJ Jagodowski, both improvisers here in Chicago. Abby has a one-woman show called Work in Progress at I.O. Friday nights at 10:30. She's not doing it this Friday. It's lazy. But she will be doing it.
Love wins,
right. But she will be on stage there. You can check out TJ. You can see him wherever you want to see him. He's just awesome. Okay, so let's keep going with this. Let's go to Susan. Thanks for holding, Susan. Susan, what's the worst?
I was working retail, and my boss gave me pepper spray for protection.
Yeah.
So I put it in my jean pocket, and I went out that night dancing. And when I came home to my studio apartment, I unloaded my change from my pockets. And when I put my hand in my pocket, I released the mace on myself.
Oh,
and I had
so
nowhere
stingy.
To go.
Yeah, what do you
so
do?
So I had to open up all the windows in the apartment and stand on the back porch till it cleared out. And that stuff really works.
I'm so happy, Susan, that you did it to yourself at home in a non-emergency situation as opposed to when you really needed it. Right. As though, you know, like, right. As though to give your attacker an extra edge by macing yourself.
That's amazing. But that's...
You picked the right time to do it.
That's right. If it's going to happen.
That's hard, man. That stings.
Oh, that's... All right.
No, I'll buy it. I'll buy it. So I was 16. No, Susan, thanks for that.
No problem.
Okay, there we go. I got a ton of texts here. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. What's the worst? Complain about the worst things in society for prizes.
Come on.
All right. Hold on. The worst is when you're... Okay, I'm just going to make sure. Okay, this is 331. The worst is when I was playing a slot machine, had $200 plus in credits, and in a bonus round when the electricity went out.
Oh! No.
That's a scam. I mean, maybe it's not. I don't know if it's a scam.
The whole casino went off?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh!
Or just the Brady Bunch slot.
That one hurts. That one hurts.
It's just one slot just one that goes up. Oh, sorry. Oh. I'm so sorry.
I just hit Alice's ham.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder this what machine it was.
This is exactly.
I mean, I know those machines. If it was Cleopatra, it's so darn hard to get so that. That would drive me nuts. Little Red Riding Hood. Oh, man. I can go through them all.
224 says the real worst. Uh-oh. I finally replaced my wedding ring after not having the old one for years. Bunches of tiny diamonds. Two have fallen out only a few months after getting it.
My diamonds.
So as she sent a picture of her ring.
Oh, my gosh.
There are holes in this ring.
Is it insured, I wonder? It has to be.
No, I hope so.
You're leaking diamonds. Oh, talk about first world problems. My diamonds. I mean... It's not good, but you're losing. Yeah. You know, you don't lose your meal money.
It's like, it's covered in diamonds. I've lost two.
920 says, this is for Abby. This is James. The donut room is the room at the Motel 6 where they serve free breakfast. Don't tell me you haven't been there.
Okay. Who is this, James?
Yeah.
Take down the judgment a little bit, James. And I haven't been to that Motel 6, but don't think I'm not going there directly after this. TJ, you don't mind driving me out there, do you?
Not at all.
Thanks, dude.
This is a good one. 773. The worst is when you ask a girl if she wants to go out to eat. I was wearing sweatpants and a tank top. And she comes out thinking it's a fancy date, and she's wearing a nice dress and high heels.
Aww. So that the worst that you would actually show up for a date in? Yeah, that is the worst.
Sweatpants and tank top. I would just say... In any situation where you ask anybody to go out to eat, you may want to put on jeans, right?
Yeah.
I think so.
I mean, that's just a given.
That might be worst for her.
Yeah.
How embarrassing.
I think she's I guess it's not good for anybody, but it might be even worse for her.
I mean, heels
this is really
good
not good for anybody involved.
I had this so wrong.
You got the Pequods and the pillow. What's happening here?
This is terrible. 630. And I you can never tell. I mean, this is the worst if it actually happened, but it's probably a joke. The worst, I had an operation and they hit something and now my privates are smaller.
They hit the button that shrinks your junk.
There it is.
What did they hit?
773 says the worst is listening to callers with multiple worsts. That's not nice.
Come on, Bonnie, leave Bonnie alone.
708, the worst is Bonnie the maker rules. Of Pokemon.
Yes, agreed. But I still don't know what it is, so hit me up.
Can't be the worst because there's someone who made sarin gas.
You know what I mean? That's true.
Of all the things that have been made, that guy can't be the worst.
He doesn't even make the top 25.
No.
TJ always brings it back. You're right,
he does,
TJ.
He does.
Yeah. You're right.
He puts it in perspective.
Yeah.
630 says the worst are Facebook friends that are only self-promoting themselves all day.
That is pretty crummy.
Don't care about anybody else.
That is pretty crummy.
That is.
Meanwhile, Abby's got a...
Gosh darn it, you guys! You know what's taking everything? I haven't sworn once. I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, we're only halfway through.
I just said, gosh darn it. I'm nailing it.
219 says, this is a joke, I think. 219, the worst isn't Zika. It's the Kanye West virus where babies may be born with big heads.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it's
good. Yeah, okay.
It's very Jay Leno.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, talk about the worst. Jay Leno, huh? I don't know what that huh was. Huh?
708, the worst is when you recognize someone from an event in the past and you go to talk to them and they have no idea who you are.
That hurts.
Okay.
That happens.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, if that happens a lot,
then
you got to work on your personality. You know what I mean? You got to start wearing a hat that is easily recognizable.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I start wearing a hat. They'd be like, oh, it's the lesbian Minnie Pearl. I remember her. You're like, I'm on board.
Does that set you apart from the original?
Oh, know. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
Get your fact checker on that.
You might have to be the second lesbian mini Burrow.
You know what? I'll take it.
All right, let's go to Steve.
Steve, right. What's the worst, Steve?
Oh, the worst is when your back hurts so bad, you got to, on a night like tonight, you got to use your seat heater and your air conditioning at the same time.
That's
agreed.
One of those things is not like the other.
I have back problems myself, dude, and that is rough stuff. Apologies.
There you go.
I'm serious.
Yeah, you got serious for a second. I never see you get serious. You got serious right there.
I'm multi-layered, Justin.
I'd say layered. I don't know if you're multi-layered.
He's like the old McDLT. He's got to keep the cool side cool and the hot side hot right now. He's got a front-back war going on. Somewhere in the middle of his body, it's looking to split.
So good. 708 says, the worst thing ever is when you're 5 minutes late for the free Slurpee day and it's 95 degrees out.
5 minutes?
What's that? Not the worst thing ever, but to get a free...
712 on 712?
Yeah, I think if you're like midnight.
You had a whole day, man. A whole day. I got no pity.
Are you kidding? You got 364 days to get ready. Yeah, what do you mean a whole day? You got 364 days.
You can plan now. I got no pity.
708 says, the worst is the guy who I worked with who conned me to download Pokemon Go, thus ruining my life. A lot of Pokemon Go stuff. 773, World Star Videos, the worst.
What's that?
That's a video site. You go to World Star. It's a World Star Hip Hop.
I was going
to
say that's hip hop stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's just, oh, look at this guy on a skateboard and he fell down. World Star. Like that kind of stuff. That's essentially what it is. He's right. It is the worst, but I don't know if it's.
So it's not, is it hip hop or is it people falling down?
It's a little bit of both. But
it's worldstarhiphop.com, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I think I like this. Hip hop and people getting choned on skateboards and stuff?
312 says, the worst is when you ask your friend to a movie. And he says, okay. And when you tell him it's a horror film, he tells you he's busy.
What did he come out wearing?
He was in a tuxedo with a cummerbund.
And a lit candelabra.
Yeah.
And a man playing violin. I was in my Freddy Krueger fingers.
Oh, my God. So funny tonight.
My striped sweater.
312 says, the worst is a grown man watching and admitting to said offense, watching the Kardashians. They're making fun of me.
Yesterday I watched,
on Sunday I binge-watched like the whole season of the Kardashians.
Was it worth it?
It is. It's a good show. That's what I was trying to explain to people is I'm like, you know, maybe you don't like the reality part of them, that they're actually people and that you have to, they hog up your news feed. But the actual keeping up with the Kardashians, the way it's edited, it's a nice little structure. You care about the sisters. You care about the stuff. I don't care if it's fake. I don't care. It's fake. It's reality fake.
Interesting.
Right? I think it's good.
All right. All
right. She knows what I'm talking about.
I might give it a chance then.
Keeping Up with the Kardashians. It's on E. You'll love it. It's a new show. Season 12.
I just given Justin dagger eyes. Give me a break.
These Kardashians, I've never heard of them.
Sorry.
Are they all lawyers?
They're all lawyers.
Oh, okay.
It's a lawyer. Like it's a lawyer job. It's like L.A. Law, but reality.
I like law.
Oh, my God.
Harry Hamlin's in it. It's
really good. I was
going
to say, Harry Hamlin made
Michael
it real.
Michael Tucker. Jill Eisenreich.
Wait,
we skipped right over Jimmy Smits.
Oh, my God. Jimmy Smits. I'm sorry.
No love for Jimmy Smits.
Yeah. Jimmy Smits. Can we talk about men that play detective in procedural crime dramas? We'll get back to it. Because they
different
are the
segment,
best.
Different segment.
Hashtag the best.
Hey, we'll do the best. Instead of doing the worst, we'll do the best.
I'd love to.
All right, there we go. All right, 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We'll do the last round, and we'll pick the winners. Stay with us.
It's going down,
it's the worst here on the download. 312-981-7200. We're complaining about society for prizes. There's no better way to complain. I mean, you could complain at home, and you could do, you know, and everyone's just like, yeah.
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 Here you complain here, and you get a good complaint, and you're like, you know what? I'm going to give you a gift card to Pequod's.
Yeah, dog.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, man.
TJ, check it out.
I'm calling next Tuesday.
Abby McEnany. All right, Abby's got a one-woman show. It's called Work in Progress. It's going to be at I.O. Friday nights, 10:30. Not this next Friday.
Right. But through August.
Yeah, I can't get you to break. You're too good. All right, 773 says, the worst is when a coworker brings in delicious homemade muffins. After you've eaten half, you see that your muffin is full of cat hair.
Oh, God.
That is the worst. Whoa.
That's gross. And a health violation.
That doesn't burn up.
Oh.
Cat hair survives the,
piping hot baking temperature.
This is, man, these are, wow. Tonight is, I mean, it is All-Star Weekend.
Oh, man. It's raw.
But it's good. These are good, man. This is hard. This is hard.
This is home run derby.
It really is. Listen to this one. You guys are going to love this one. 773 says, the absolute worst is going to a wake and realizing you're wearing the same dress as the woman in the casket.
Whoa.
No way.
Whoa.
Right? Oh. That's the worst. That is the worst.
You'd be like, I mean, that's like, you know, Us Magazine, they're like, oh my God, J-Lo and Julia Roberts were so embarrassed. They were, oh man, you're dressing.
That sounds like that should be followed with, and then you realize it's your own way.
And then it turns out it's a horror movie, and your date cancels on you.
And you have the same face as the person in the room.
847 says, the worst is when the doctor prescribes a high dose of magnesium to combat migraines, and you have your cup of Morning Joe, and you can't quite make it to the bathroom. Bible. So Bible means it's for real. And then 847 said, Justin should get that from the Kardashians binge. I did not see that episode, so that must have happened to one of them.
Okay. Magnesium, eh? I get migraines. I'll start loading up on that.
You want to get political, guys?
Yeah, you know.
Yes.
You were down there? 847 says, the worst is when your candidate preaches social change and fixing the system and then endorses Hillary Clinton.
All right.
I like me some Bernie.
Hey, I warned you guys.
I know. I love it. And actually, like, if we had time for discourse, man, I am in on board. But
what's
like,
he going to do? What's can he going to do?
I know, honestly. Can we have people who are like, well, you know, now I'm not going to vote for anybody. I'm sorry.
All right.
Give me a break.
A couple of addendums here. 224 says the diamonds are under warranty.
Oh, thank God.
These are tiny, cheap diamonds. I usually hate jewelry. So I think she's trying to endear herself to us.
Oh, I wasn't putting her down.
You guys seem to be like, ooh, you're leaking diamonds, first world rich lady. So she's coming back and saying, hold on.
All right, modestly wealthy lady, Luke, leaking loose, cheap diamonds.
That were still important
Wouldn't that be insured? Wouldn't that be nice to be able to refer to diamonds as loose and cheap? Oh, good Lord. You're just digging yourself a bigger hole.
331 says, the whole casino went out. There was a storm.
Gosh.
That sounds like the beginning of Ocean's 14.
I don't think that one's going to win, but that, man, does that hurt.
That does hurt.
You can pump away at that machine just begging, just hunting for one of those bonuses, and then you land one.
Slots
and then
are my jam.
I love the
slots.
I wish I knew which machine this was. Black Widow.
312 says the worst is clammy skin.
It's not great.
My AC is out and my skin. This is good. It feels like moist yeast dough.
All right.
Flies are sticking to me.
Oh,
no. Oh, that's a separate problem.
All right. Here's a good one. Oh, these are all good, man. I'm telling you, it's like the All-Star game. It's like the seventh inning and the guy comes off the bench. You're like, I like that guy too. He's played again.
It's like
game.
Glenn Allen Hill.
Oh, gosh. 708 says, the worst when your crazy mother-in-law hears about the special birthday present you've been planning to get your children for months. And then she gives him the same present the week before just to spite you.
What?
The worst is when your husband knows about the scheme and says you're overreacting and then denies he knew you were getting the gift. Wow.
Okay. Mama issues from that gentleman right there.
Text back to Justin your mother-in-law's cell phone number and I will anonymously text her nonstop. I am outraged. This is me at a low outrage.
To not get the backing of your spouse in that situation,
I mean, honestly,
is low down dirty.
Yeah, that's tough.
Low down.
And then text me your husband's thing, and I'll send her some counseling options.
You know, I'll take the other side.
Oh, here.
Saying
that's hard to believe.
No, but what if the guy is just kind of, what if the side of that family is just kind of aloof?
What if the mom is a little bit older and she's like, oh, that sounds great. And then the husband's like, ah, I wasn't even paying attention.
No. I don't know.
So it's not it's bad, but it's not nefarious bad.
No.
Yeah. I mean, the worst part of that, I feel like, is getting not backed by your spouse.
The mom, the mother-in-law thing, that is nefarious.
Yeah.
She knew what was happening. Absolutely. She's like, that's the husband thing. I'm like, that's.
Well, we're taking your relationship calls here at 312-981-7020.
Forever single app. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about.
All right. So there's a couple more here, but we're going to move on because we got to wrap the show. Let me. Pumpkin.
Oh, that's sweet, Gord. I don't know. I couldn't think of something endearing.
All right, here we go. So number three is going to get a Pequod's Pizza gift card featuring world-famous pizza with a signature caramelized cheese crust. To visit them in Chicago or Morton Grove or online at pequodspizza.com. Number two is going to get a pair of tickets to Air Supply with Blood, Sweat, and Tears on July 16th at River Edge Park. I didn't mention that. Yeah.
Buried the lead on that
one. Come on, man.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Now, that's an entire... Let the spinning wheels spin. What goes up?
Almost.
Now, that's the winner.
Oh, man.
Here are the hits of the 60s, 70s, and 80s that were on your soundtrack to your favorite moments. Get tickets online at riveredgeaurora.com or call 630-896-6666. And number one is going to get a MyPillow, guaranteed the most comfortable pillow you'll ever own. Visit MyPillow.com. All right. So number three tonight is going to get the Pequod's. This is going to go to the phoners. This is this was on the phone, and her name was Patty.
Mm-hmm.
And Patty was complaining about the waitress that put her fingers in the eggs.
Yep.
Coincidentally, at a casino. Maybe yes, there's a tie together. Like, this is all the same. It's like a bad, like the movie Slacker. Like, it all comes together. All these
link letters on it.
Yeah,
link.
Tell you, you're not going to get any body parts dangled in your Pequod's.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
So you there you can, go. So we guaranteed. Thought about that for you. This is an this is Patty. This is. This gives you a chance to get a gift card and get some pizza.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Number two, the Air Supply tickets with Blood, Sweat, and Tears are going to go to Pam, who also was on the phone.
Yes.
Pam was the woman who said that the worst is when you are having a serious phone conversation and then you realize that the phone cut out, but you didn't stop and you continued. And then you don't know when they cut out. That is the worst.
That's really.
And you have decreed that a pillow is better than the multi-platinum combination of Air Supply and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. That a bean-filled sack is.
That is so true. But it is it's a nice pillow.
It is, yeah. I hear
dude,
you.
Dude, man.
These are not in order of
child born this world to carry on. Boom, boom, boom,
the number boom, one tonight boom, who's gonna win the MyPillow, guaranteed the most comfortable pillow you've ever owned.
All right.
Visit MyPillow.com is of course it has to be Bonnie!
Woo! Use it in good health, Bonnie.
Bonnie's
absolutely.
On the line. Bonnie. We decided that early on you set the bar so high for this. It made it an all-star night because people wanted to keep up with you, but yeah, it was you're the worst.
You know what? I didn't even tell you all of it. My dog, I cooked the chicken that made me sick for my dog. He got salmonella, my little 10-pound dog.
Oh.
But they don't have to go stay in the hospital and get all these strong drugs. They heal all by themselves.
Funny. It's amazing.
Not only did you win
from telling us a long story, but there was more.
But Bonnie, also there are not two pillows. You know that there's not. There's only one
dog's
pillow. Just
well,
joking.
I understand.
No, you're amazing. I'm just doing.
I give it to my dog.
Oh,
no, I'm kidding.
Bonnie.
No, I'm always buying a new pillow because I like my thing is you know a woman. It's part of our. Gene setup. We have to have all
there
these
you go.
Pillows. So.
We actually wanted to give you the.
So nice.
We wanted to make sure we gave you the prize so we could call you back to make sure you live through the show, Bonnie.
Well, I'll tell you, there is something kind of funny that did happen when I picked up the phone. They said, "He said, can you stay in the line?" I said, "Sure."
So I'm walking with my cell phone, and I go to turn down the radio.
No.
And I knock over my CD holder with all my CDs.
Oh, okay, good. That's not the worst. Right. That's not the worst.
I swear to God. No, it wasn't the worst. Right, that egg thing, really, I thought, oh, my gosh. But I also didn't tell you that after I had the salmonella and was in the hospital for 7 days, I had to have endoscopy and a colonoscopy.
Right. No, Bonnie.
And they had a biopsy, like 6 parts of my stomach, and everything was absolutely fine.
All right, good. All right. Bonnie, I'm grateful. Thank you for giving us, to me, I feel like there's something in there that is wonderful about this segment. The idea that there were a lot of worse there, but it worked out for Bonnie.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the day, she got to see Adele, even though it was construction. And at the end of the day, she got the pillows.
And she's made me feel like I have a new lease on life.
TJ Jagodowski, Abby McEnany, thanks so much for being here
tonight,
Justin. Guys.
Thanks for letting us.
Bye, Pete.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. That's going to do it for the download tonight. Join us tomorrow night. We got much more to come. Diggable Planets.
Are you serious?
I am serious. Yeah, Diggable Planets. They're playing Pitchfork this weekend, and they will be Ishmael Butler will join us to talk about his career, Diggable Planets' career, and the reunion tour for the influential hip hop group.
Oh my god!
From Brooklyn.
That's cool.
So we'll be back tomorrow night. Patty Vasquez up next.